Blog Talk Radio.
It's 3 p.m., and I have a question for you. Do you know where your politicians are? Everything is political in your life, from the moment you're born to the moment you die. And when a politician tells you that's not true, look in your pocket. You'll find their hand in it. Everything is political. We will be talking to those politicians that are working for you and talking about those politicians that are working against you. Just because they're a Democrat, or just because they're a Republican, and you voted that way your entire life, maybe you were wrong. Because everybody is not what they seem to be. However, there are a few out there who are working for your benefit, and we are going to bring them to you. We're going to let you hear them. We're going to ask them questions. We're going to let you ask them questions. And we're going to be discussing education system, the military, science, music, sports, oh, and healthcare. Do you have it? Do you need it? Are your 26-year-olds still on the family health care plan? Or, as the regressive party says, Obamacare. We will bring you what you need to know, because this is the last word. And everything, from the cities, counties, state, nation, the entire world. So sit down and get a pencil, paper, and take this graduate education experience. And we will make sure that you have the last word. My name is Michael Lawson.
Finally, some images are out of this world as NASA's Perseverance.
Good afternoon, everyone. Excuse me.
It's Friday, March the 19th, 2021, and this is The Last Word. I'm Michael Lawson, speaking on behalf of Mr. Thomas Fortenberry and Mr. Michael Brogan, associate producers. I mean, can you believe the idiocy? Well, I really don't know if it's idiocy. I think it's just complete racism. That this regressive party, since they no longer have control of the White House, the Senate, and the House, what they're doing now, well, I shouldn't say what they're doing now. They've been doing this for the last 5 years. They've hooked themselves up because they found themselves in a position where they know they cannot win anything anymore. They now have found themselves in a position where they don't give a damn who they insult, how they insult them, and don't give a damn what you think about it. I mean, it's always been something with this regressive party that they have insulted African Americans, Hispanics, Asians, anybody who's not like them. Anybody. But you know, most of them have kept it under wraps because they had the fear of not getting reelected. They were just a little bit on the, okay, I won't say that. I'm going to keep it, but I'll mention it at the dinner parties to my other racist comrades. I'll mention it when I'm in the corner barbershop. I'll mention it when I'm in the corner bar. But I won't mention that on the air when newspapers and TV and people that have half a brain might think there was something wrong with it. They wouldn't do that because they were scared. But when they saw the racist in chief become president, when they saw the racist in chief come down the escalator with his so-called wife, when they saw the racist in chief talk about, well, most of the people coming in here, a few of them maybe are all right, but racists, the rest of them are all carrying drugs and are raping and stealing and murdering you, especially if you're sleeping. They've been saying that about African Americans for hundreds of years, but they also have been saying that about Asian, our American, Asian, and Pacific partners. Oh, yeah. They've been mentioning that for years. But now it's gotten to the point when this clown, the orange man that finally got into the White House, he's saying that, and he's the president of the United States. It's got to be all right for us to say this now. It's got to be all right to say whatever we want. I mean, he's even going along with his his good buddy Putin, who's been the utmost criminal in the world, and he is buddy-buddy with him. So if he's buddy-buddy with him, what the hell? What's he going to do to us? We're only saying what he's saying. We're saying that we're his focal point. You know, we're not the hose that the water comes out. We're the water. So, well, this man has been saying for years that all them people are there, they don't like us. We don't need them. We're going to eliminate them because we're going to take over all the cities and the states. We're going to take over the governor's mansions. We'll control everything that finally gets to the federal government. And then we'll control the judgeships. Because, you know, those people don't vote anyway. All we need is about 33%. And we'll control the market. We'll control everything. So they thought. So they thought. But you see, shit comes home to roost. Oh, yeah. Shit comes home to roost. And when that does, hey, you see what happens when shit comes home to roost.
Shit happens.
And they now have a major problem. Oh, yeah. Because people ain't going for that shit anymore. No, they're not. They're not going for it. And believe me, buddy, these people think that it's all right. It's all right. Don't worry about it. It's all right. I'm the president. I tell you what that you need to know. Oh, yeah. I tell you that. Because when I tell you that you can do what the hell you want to do, when I tell you that you can do what the hell you want to do, whatever you want, because we need to make sure that these people, these so-called, I forgot what you call them, these morons that are out there voting for us, get the clue that we're in charge. We're in charge. They ain't in charge. I mean, do you know what the, I mean, in the last, I believe it's the last year, there's been over almost 3,800 violations, criminal attacks on the Asian community, Asian American community. You realize that? I mean, what the hell? Can you believe it? It's outrageous. That's right. It's outrageous. They have had a horrible time. You know what? What does it matter when we're in charge? You got a daggone captain of police down some hobunk town in Georgia that claims this clown that killed 6 Asian Americans, Asian American citizens, and not citizens, but Asian Americans, killed 8 people, that he had just had a bad day. That's all it was. He had a bad day. That's what he had. That's what he's claiming. He had a bad day. And you know what happens? When you have a bad day, things go bad. Not only for you, but for anybody that's around you. I know it's pretty sad. But that's how things are sometimes. Just listen to this.
Just 2 days after the shooting rampage that killed eight, six of them Asian American, another minority group is being forced to demand a reckoning in America. A short time ago, the president ordered flags at half staff for the victims killed in the Atlanta area shootings. And tomorrow, he and the vice president plan to meet with Asian American leaders when they visit the city. Today, the House is holding a hearing on anti-Asian hate in the country after months of reports of bigoted attacks increasing during the pandemic, fueled by bigoted rhetoric based on the virus originating in China. Investigators in Georgia say it's still not clear whether racist hate was behind the murders there, detailing that the suspect, Robert Aaron Long, told them he acted out in distress over a sexual addiction. Long's court appearance today was canceled. We will get the latest on the investigation first, though, to the House hearing on anti-Asian attacks, in which a Texas congressman spewed the exact rhetoric that is blamed for inciting the racism while invoking terms tied to lynching. It forced one Asian American congresswoman to respond quite forcefully. Let's watch.
The victims of race-based violence and their families deserve justice. And as the case, what we're talking about here with the tragedy, what we just saw occur in Atlanta, Georgia. I would also suggest that the victims of cartels moving illegal aliens deserve justice. The American citizens in South Texas that are getting absolutely decimated by what's happening at our southern border deserve justice. The victims of rioting and looting in the streets last week, businesses closed, burned last summer, deserve justice. We believe in justice. Right? There's old sayings in Texas about, you know, find all the rope in Texas and get a tall oak tree. We take justice very seriously, and we ought to do that. Round up the bad guys. That's what we believe. My concern about this hearing is that it seems to want to venture into the policing of rhetoric in a free society, free speech, and away from the rule of law taking out bad guys. So now we're talking about whether talking about China, the Chi-Coms, the Chinese Communist Party, whatever phrasing we want to use, and if some people are saying, hey, we think those guys are the bad guys for whatever reason. And let me just say clearly, I do. I think the Chinese Communist Party running the country of China, I think they're the bad guys. I'm not going to be ashamed of saying I oppose the Chi-Coms. I oppose the Chinese Communist Party. And when we say things like that and we're talking about that, we shouldn't be worried about having a committee of members of Congress policing our rhetoric because some evildoers go engage in some evil activity as occurred in Atlanta, Georgia. Who decides what is hate? Who decides what is the kind of speech that deserves policing?
I want to go back to something that Mr. Roy said earlier. Your president and your party and your colleagues can talk about issues with any other country that you want, but you don't have to do it by putting a bullseye on the back of Asian Americans across this country, on our grandparents, on our kids. This hearing was to address the hurt and pain of our community and to find solutions, and we will not let you take our voice away from us.
I'm joined now by Democratic Congressman Andy Kim of New Jersey. Congressman, what was your reaction to that moment?
My reaction was one of just diving into the words of Congresswoman Grace Meng. And she spoke for all of us. She spoke for those victims. She spoke for people who are trying to be heard and seen right now, not just be used as some type of rhetorical pivot for our colleagues in Congress to change the subject to something else. Now is the time for us to have that deep dive and that true look at ourselves in terms of the racism and the hatred So I'm glad that Congresswoman Grace Benz stood up for me, my family, for the Asian American community around the country.
It seemed like Congressman Roy was trying to decouple rhetoric that, say, might have to do with the Chinese government from the crimes that we've seen. We don't know, look, we don't know what the motive is in Atlanta, but it doesn't escape anyone that six of the eight victims are Asian American women. And it seems like he's trying to decouple the rhetoric, which has increased, from the incidents that have increased. And there are many that have been documented. We've talked about them on the show just here in the last hour or so. What do you say to that, of him trying to say there is, it appears, no connection?
Well, what he's doing is not trying to decouple. What he's doing is trying to change the topic. He doesn't want to talk about the issues of racism and discrimination in our nation. He didn't. We're in the aftermath, less than 48 hours since a mass murder, and he used his time to talk about changing the subject in that way rather than thinking about the American people that were killed and the families that are still mourning. He is dramatically just out of touch with the challenges that the Asian American community are facing, the pain that we are facing. So that's why he's just trying to change the subject to something that he knows better, something that he feels more comfortable talking about, rather than doing the hard work of digging into this extremely difficult and painful issue of racism that the AAPI community is facing.
He invoked lynching, and not just lynching, but lynching as if it were justice. He used a phrase about lynching, which has a dark, dark history and a racist history in Texas, and he talked about that as if it were justice.
Yeah, well, look, he no doubt used language that is absolutely offensive. And look, I absolutely condemn the use of that language, and I believe that he was trying to change the subject and trying to move on from something that we need to confront. But look, I don't want to focus on him. I want to focus on the victims in Atlanta, their families. I want to focus in on the AAPI community around this country that is grieving and fearful yesterday and today going forward. I mean, the calls that I'm getting, people breaking down, unsure what's going to happen next. That's where we need to rally around. That's what we need to be focused on.
What are you hearing from your constituents or from people that you know about what they have dealt with in this last year or so compared to before the pandemic?
They've experienced a lot, and I've felt it too. I've had experiences, my family's had experiences where we've had people say racist remarks at us, try to get away, you know, step away from us because they tell us to get away from them. They think they're going to get the coronavirus from us simply because we're Asian Americans. But look, the challenges that we face, certainly over the last year, gasoline has been poured on this fire, but the discrimination that the AAPI community has faced preceded COVID. It'll be around after COVID. You know, this is something deep, but people are feeling real pain right now, and what they want to have is be known that they're being seen and heard. I'm glad that the president and the vice president will go down to Atlanta tomorrow. That is certainly a big step, and I'm grateful for the leadership.
Congressman Kim, thank you so much for being with us.
President Joe Biden is about to sign a presidency-defining bill. The GOP, the party of no, trying to distract and deflect with some really shameful statements about race, like this disgusting claim that Black Lives Matter doesn't like families.
I know the strength that Black Lives Matter had in this last election. I know it's a group that it doesn't like the old-fashioned family. Disturbed that we have another program here in which we're increasing the marriage penalty.
Come on. Doesn't like the old-fashioned family. What does that mean when Black Lives Matter was about police brutality and violence and trying to keep family members and loved ones alive. Sounds like family values to me. What he said is not even coded racism. That's right out, saying it right out loud. So
saying it right out loud. And people show you who they are, huh? He thinks he can just throw it in as an aside about Black Lives Matter, like nothing, the old-fashioned family. What is it, what does old-fashioned mean? Huh? What does old-fashioned mean? What does that mean? Someone asking that? Insulting millions and millions of black families. Stacey Plaskett, not having it, not any of it.
How dare you? How dare you say that Black Lives Matter? Black people do not understand old-fashioned families. Despite some of the issues, some of the things that you have put forward that I've heard out of your mouth in the Oversight Committee, in your own district, we have been able to keep our families alive for over 400 years, and the assault on our families to not have black lives or not even have black families. How dare you say that we are not interested in families in the black community? That is outrageous.
It is outrageous. And again, if I have to say this every single night of my life while I'm here, I will. You need to know the history of this country. Do you know how many black families were separated during slavery? I've had my ancestry done twice. It is so hard to even find records that go back even two generations sometimes, because what? The intentional separation of black families. And no records. You know why? They were considered property. So it's this, God, ugh. It just angers me sometimes that people can be so ignorant. And then there's Tim Scott. Tim Scott is the only black, the only black Republican in the Senate, telling Fox News, of course Fox News, that what he calls woke supremacy is as bad as white supremacy.
Woke supremacy is as bad as white supremacy.
What does that mean?
Do you want to explain who these woke supremacists are? Because I looked really carefully and I didn't. Hang on, before we go to the video. I haven't seen any woke supremacists. I've never seen a woke supremacist lynching anybody. Never saw a woke supremacist denying anybody access to housing or job or education or voting rights. Never saw any woke supremacists enslaving anybody. Never saw any woke supremacists trying to keep people from marrying amongst different races. Come on, Tim Scott. I didn't see any woke supremacists storming the blanket Capitol. Where are the woke supremacists attacking police? Where are the woke supremacists hunting police officers in the halls of the Capitol and beating them with Blue Lives Matter signs with white supremacist insignia on their shirts and carrying white supremacist paraphernalia? Guess who I saw? Guess who police officers were beaten by? Guess who wanted to hang the vice president? White supremacist, Tim Scott! What are you doing? The only black Republican were the woke supremacists carrying the Confederate battle flag in the nation's capital, Tim Scott. Tim, I have to. I know you don't want me to yell, but this is ridiculous. You are gaslighting people. You are giving people misinformation. What are you doing, brother? What are you doing? What are you doing? You're not helping. And then there's Lindsey Graham. Of course, Lindsey Graham. $5 million, $5 million in aid to black farmers in the COVID relief bill. He is calling that reparations.
If you're a farmer, your loan will be forgiven up to 120% of your loan, not 100%, but 120% of your loan if you're socially disadvantaged, if you're African American, some other minority. But if you're a white person, if you're a white woman, no forgiveness. That's reparations.
This is 2021. Please tell me we're not going to fall for this. Why are we allowing people to do this? And why are people doing this? Lindsey Graham, why are you doing this? It's not helpful to the country. Senior Democratic leader James Clyburn slamming Graham for that.
He ought to be ashamed of himself. He knows the history in this country, and he knows what has happened to black farmers. Lindsey ought to be ashamed.
And what do you say to Lindsey Graham or whomever who says that this is a form of reparations?
Well, I think you ought to go back and maybe go to church, get in touch with his Christianity.
Thank you, Congressman Clyburn. Thank you, thank you, thank you.
Well, we have the chairman of the AAIP for the North Carolina Democratic Party, Ms. Dr. Grace Lean, with us. Dr. Grace, can you help us out here understand what the hell this Progressive Party is talking about?
No, I can't. no, I can't, and yes, I can. I mean, in two different.
What are they saying?
Yeah, well, I cannot explain in the sense that there's no fixing stupid. But I can explain it in the sense that the Republicans have now for decades spread and utilized the concept of divide and conquer and instilling fear in the less fortunate and the less educated, because only in that way can they actually control, and that's what it's all about, control the population and fool them into voting against their own best interests. Now, this massacre, this hate crime that occurred in Georgia, I wanted to tell you that when I heard about it, I was filled with anger and horror and sadness and frustration and you know, all these emotions were mixed up inside of me. And I knew that I would have to do something, and I knew that I would have to write something. But I got to tell you, it took me 2 days to finally be able to put down something that did not reek of the anger that I was feeling. My anger is still in the letter that I, the article that I wrote. It's still there, but it's not what I would have written had I started immediately. I am not so naive as to say that, this is just a one-time incident, and certainly it doesn't... I'm not going to parrot what the Republicans are trying to say by using the ridiculous, okay, I don't like Chinese communists, bullpucky. They don't like Chinese communists, but they sure as hell love them Russian communists. They love them Russian communists a whole lot.
Chip Roy talking about? What was he talking about? Talk about the Chinese communists. We're talking about what happened in Atlanta.
He doesn't know. But look at, but I want you to sit back and look at this. The Russian communists are white. The Chinese communists are people of color. So it's a racism thing. You know, it's okay, we can embrace Russian communists, but we cannot embrace Chinese communists because the Chinese communists don't look like us. They're people of color. They're the yellow peril. For decades, we've been, the Asians have been discriminated against. We've had a long, long history of anti-Asian hate in America, but it is only since Donald Trump's rhetoric, and it is only since Donald Trump came into the White House that hate crimes have risen over 900% in hate speech on Twitter directed towards China and the Chinese, a 200% increase in traffic to hate sites and specific posts against Asians, 70% increase in hate between kids and teens. Kids and teens. Imagine that. I mean, what are we doing to our children? We are bringing them up to hate each other? You know, we've had Chinese, or I mean, we've had Asians slashed from ear to ear with a box cutter. We've had a 16-year-old student in the San Fernando Valley who was beaten so badly by his classmates, not strangers, classmates, that he had to go to the emergency room and, of course, suffered concussions, and he is still recovering from the trauma of being beaten by his friends, his classmates.
Right.
Mm-hmm. We have women, you know, Asian women standing in line, you know, to at a checkout and having white people come up to them and spraying them with a can of Lysol saying, go home, you're the infection, take your flu, your Kung flu with you. We don't want you here. This to a woman who was born and bred in America. You know, women, the crimes that have accelerated, occurring mostly against the women, Asian women, elderly Asians, and children. Think about them, the most vulnerable group of us all. So think about the people that are perpetrating these crimes. They're bullies. And these are bullies that have been empowered and encouraged by Donald J. Trump. He's not in office anymore. But this, but the hate groups are still there. They're still there. We've got, you know, the xenophobia against Asians goes back to the 1800s. This is when America decided that they needed little Asian people to come over and help them build the Transcontinental Railroad, and they brought the Asians over the Middle Passage across the Pacific, just like they were bringing the African Americans in the Middle Passage across the Atlantic. We're slaves in both ways. The harassment, the racism, the torture, the beatings, the homicides, the rapes that were occurred against the Asians were gone unreported. And Asians, because we're Asians, we put our heads down, and our motto is, don't make waves. Don't make any trouble. So we've taught ourselves, our parents taught us and our ancestors taught us, don't make trouble, because if you make trouble, then you have bad karma. So don't make trouble. So we didn't say anything. We didn't complain. We just simply accepted the fact that, yes, we were going to be permanent victims. We were going to be permanent and consistent victims of racism, of hatred, of rape, of genocide. We accepted it. Imagine that, an entire Asian, an entire race accepting the fact that genocide was what we had to get used to. And it wasn't just in America. The British Empire, when they colonized India and when they colonized Southeast Asia, the French, when they colonized, you know, Indochina, renamed it Indochina. The Dutch, when they took out Indonesia, all of these white people came to the lands that were rich in natural resources, that were populated by brown people and black people, and decided that they were going to simply declare this land for themselves. And in so doing, they enslaved the native population of those lands. They made them into servants. In some countries, they were not even allowed to make salt from the sea, because if they did, they could get themselves hung or tortured and then ultimately killed. They could not even weave their own cloth. They had to import cloth from Britain because that's the way Britain got rich. They weren't even allowed. In Southeast Asia, and by the way, who taught the English how to tap rubber trees? The English didn't come in, and the Dutch didn't come in with this, oh, we know how to do it. They learned how to do it from the very native people who have been tapping rubber trees forever. But
you mean there's not a lot of rubber trees in England? There's not a lot of rubber trees in England? I didn't know that.
Well, there you go then, huh? So, but when they came and planted their white flags, their flags, in the name of their white countries, they decided that now the brown people were inferior. And they were inferior and now were slaves. And so rape, hate crimes, torture, murder, genocide were acceptable by the invaders that came and took these lands. So now you're talking about Asians that have said all along, let's not make any waves. And why? Because we don't want to be tortured, because we don't want to be killed. And so that is the reason why, you know, here in America, you find mostly Asians, that especially from the old country, that just says, no, we don't want to make trouble. We really don't want to make trouble. But unfortunately, in our desire to not make trouble, we have wound up becoming victimized even more. So now is the time to do and to make, as the good John Lewis said, good trouble. It's time. We have to make good trouble. Because if we don't, then we are condemning ourselves to an eternity of hatred, to an eternity of xenophobia. And yes, murder and hate crimes. Now, this guy, Captain Jay Baker, did you see him when he was up there? He had this really cavalier look on his face, and it was almost like he was acting this is just such a fun thing. He said, he had a bad day. Excuse me, you had a bad day? When I have a bad day, I curl up on my couch with a pint of Ben and Jerry's flavor of the month, and I eat the whole pint of ice cream. Okay? That's my bad day. In your case, it's a single malt. I understand that.
Absolutely.
But I do not go out there and chewed up the community. I do not go out there and massacre a group of vulnerable people that have never done anything to harm a soul. I don't do that. And for him to say, for Jay Baker to say, no, it was a sex fetish. Let me tell you about sex fetishes, okay? That white man had a sex fetish about dominating Asian women, and he lived out his white supremacy by killing them. Mm-hmm. So yes, it was a hate crime. You do not go out there and kill that many people of any one race and it not be a hate crime. What are you going to call it then? An oopsie? Is that what you're going to call it? Oopsie?
An oopsie.
No.
Yeah, oopsie, right.
Yeah.
Give me
I have a sexual fetish, so I'm going to kill six of you? Do I call BS on that or what?
And not in the same town.
He sought them out. Exactly. It's not like he went to one place and did a shoot up. No, he sought out three Asian-run massage parlors, went in and massacred them. So, yes, it's a hate crime. And I honestly don't know what's taking them so damn long to call it what it is. Now, I have a bone to pick with Mayor Keisha Lance Bottom. I have a big bone to pick with her because she did not call out Captain Jay Baker. When it was brought up to her what he said, she, instead of her saying, wait a minute, no, that's inappropriate, she defended him. Absolutely not. I call her butt out. Now, I'm going to tell you how many people are now going to turn around and call me a racist because I'm calling out a black woman. Well, I'm going to tell you also that I do not support Asians just because they're Asians, because we got good Asians and we got bad Asians, like in any community. So I support the person that happens to be the most qualified or the most appropriate. And when you're not doing, you know, when you're doing something that is kind of questionable, I'm going to call you out. And I'm calling out Keisha Lance Bottoms. Absolutely. It is time for her to step up to the plate and say that her defense of Captain Jay Baker was wrong. Absolutely.
Well, listen, we need to call out anybody who doesn't live up to what their job is supposed to be. I mean, and you got to start with the senator from South Carolina. You know who I mean? The black senator from
Lindsey Lindsey Cuomo, that guy?
Not Lindsey, the black senator from South Carolina.
Oh, Tim Scott. Him. Well,
yes.
Tim Scott.
I won't even mention his name.
Tim Scott is in the same bucket as Clarence Thomas. He is in the exact same bucket as Clarence Thomas. I wonder if when Tim Scott looks at himself in the mirror, he doesn't see, does he see a black man or does he see a white man? I don't know.
No, he doesn't. Hey, you got to be a man first to see a man. He's not even a
man. That's true.
He is not even a man.
That's
now,
true.
Now, we have Diane Little is here with us. Diane? Tell us something about Mr. You know who down there we just talked about, Mr. I won't mention his name, from the senator from South Carolina, the black one, the only one.
The junior senator from South Carolina.
Yes. Oh, I didn't turn on her microphone.
He doesn't even have a mirror. He doesn't use the mirror because he doesn't want to see what he can see. He doesn't want to see. He doesn't use a mirror for what? He's being told by people like Citizen Trump and others that he's the greatest thing since sliced bread in the black community. He's different. He's special.
He's special until he
finds himself. Yeah, until he gets wake-up call and, you know. And I think Mayor Bottoms should be called out. I think Mayor Bottoms should be called out. I believe that.
She was walking on marshmallow. And listen, that's not in her district, right? She don't control that district, right? She's not a mayor of that district.
She's not his
mayor. So it shouldn't have been. The shooter,
or where the shooting happened?
Where the shooting happened with that captain, that dumb captain, who was wearing the racist T-shirt under his uniform.
Baker, right?
Right. He was wearing the racist T-shirt under his uniform.
No.
He was wearing his racist T-shirt. Go ahead.
Hi, Dr. Gracie. How are you, Diane? Listen, I can't imagine, because I've been feeling it for most of my life, which especially the last 2 years, but Baker and the shooter is actually a product of a policy that's over 400 years old in this country. They
yeah,
are
I know.
More valued. Yeah, they are more valued. And so certainly to go and do what he did, that wasn't the first time he was at those places. He has the problem.
No,
we know that.
So he said.
He has the problem. And he was able to go to those places because he knew where they were. But I can't even deal with him because he's part and parcel and a copy of a larger problem of black and people of color not only not getting justice. You need justice if something happens to you. You need respect and humanity to live in this world. And so that's what we're not getting. Lucy Liu said something last night on Vice. Was it Vice? Anyway, she said something last night on CNN, I think it was. She said that she believes that it's a pandemic of racism. Of course, it started with the last president's ideals and who he really is, which is a German, which he's probably connected to Hitler. But because of who he was, I lived in New York when there were apartment buildings that his father owned that black people could not live in. I didn't even know that. I was a kid. The major portion of this, Lucy Liu is saying that black people, people of color, need to band together. And that is something that I have wondered about for many years. You know, when you can obfuscate your ethnicity and be admitted into the greater society, you don't care about other people. And I truly believe that, you know, I believe that of Hispanics who are white, who, you know, who can pass for white. And I believe that of some Asians as well, because I've had my problems with Asian, and I can dump on them because I have family in some provinces in China. So my point is that you can't obfuscate but for so long. Sooner or later, you're going to be the other. Sooner or later, the differentiations between what people see and how they feel are going to come together and cause a problem. So I agree with Lucy Liu that minority groups, and I don't even like the word minority, but black people and people of color should actually come together because we're all meeting the same end in this country. We're all saying, what did I do but be who I am, be the ethnicity or the color that I am, that I'm going through this. And that's exactly why Asian people, mostly Asian women, are meeting their demise. This went public. There are many other stories that we've wrangled with on my Zoom on Fridays. We've wrangled with many other stories where Asian housekeepers by the man of the house, where Asian nannies. I have a niece who's a nanny, and she's told me about certain things that have happened. And like Dr. Gracie is saying, there is an atmosphere of don't make any waves, be humble, don't let your body, mind, body, and soul be broken up. And I get that, but at the same time, you have to make noise. Certainly, more of you will die, and that comes from the African American community. But it is worth the movement. It is worth taking the step. Because this is not going to stop. This is not the end of it.
Of course not. And I was looking at a statistic, and I was wondering why this other statistic, since 1885 to 1942, there's been 339 blacks lynched, 77 white, 53 Hispanic, one Native American. How come there's no nothing in there about Asian Americans? And
By the way, it's not even recorded.
Only 339? I've got to be more than that.
Yeah, well, it is, but like the data, I'm doing mental illness this week. Matter of fact, Dr. Gracie, I was going to call you. We're doing mental illness this week, and I can't even get good data on depression in African-American women. We can get it on men, and that's because men, black men, are in controlled situations like prison, the military, even sports, so they can get data about depression on those people, but there isn't a legitimate, two of the articles I read apologized for that, that they just could not gauge us as an entity because they don't have data. So now you try to get data on Asian people and you can forget about it. It's very difficult. The same stigmas that other people of color and African Americans shy away from, the same stigmas that Asians are dealing with. Dr. Gracie, am I right or wrong?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Well, what's the way that we can get this taken care of? Resolve this. How do we resolve this? Dr. Grace?
Mm-hmm.
What do you think?
How do you resolve it? Well, you know, it's a long, long, long process, and it starts with the education or the re-education of our general population, the re-education mm-hmm. of people to look. How many people know that the Bing cherry was a hybrid mm-hmm. cherry that was developed by Mr. R. Bing, and it was named for him by his white cohort? And now, see, because in those days, a person of color could not carry the byline of the invention. It had to be a white person. So even though Mr. R. Bing was the person who developed it, he could not be named as the developer or the inventor of the Bing cherry, right, which is the very sweet cherry rather than those sour things that they used to be. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
So how many people know that? How many people know that without Ramanujan and his concept of the zero theorem,
mm-hmm.
without his mathematical genius, we would not have gone to the moon or Mars. We would not understand
mm-hmm.
the black hole. These are Asians. How many people mm-hmm. know that the alphabet was actually developed by guess who? Asians. How many people know that the very first calculator was developed by Asians? How many people know that part of their everyday living, silk, porcelain, fireworks, were developed by Asians? They don't know this. How many people know that the spaghetti they eat was developed by
That's
Asians?
Right. That's right.
Mm-hmm.
They don't know this. But they do know that the Chi Coms are evil.
Oh, yeah.
See.
Of course. Mm-hmm.
So when I say that it requires all of us, it requires Asians and our allies. Now, see, this is where now I have to call out the African-American group, the African-American population as a group. So just a few weeks ago, I was told to go back to my country by an African-American woman.
Mm.
Yeah.
Where was this at?
So, this was
well,
right here in
Concord. Obviously, that was an ignorant person.
Absolutely. Absolutely, but that's what I'm talking about. I'm talking about ignorance. But I'm also talking
mm-hmm.
about the fact that, we have allowed the white people to divide us, to create
mm-hmm.
this divisiveness. Let me go back a little bit. Way in the 60s, there was a sociologist by the name of William Peterson, and he wrote in the 1960s, he wrote about the model minority groups. And what he did in his article, which I think was published in either the New York Times or the New Yorker, but his article essentially pitted one minority group against the other minority groups. And one of his arguments
mm-hmm.
was that, hey, look at the Japanese Americans. They're able to attain economic success, even though there's all this injustice. And look at you other groups like the Chinese and the Southeast Asians and the African Americans and the Hispanics. Y'all are worthless because you're not as industrious as the Japanese, who are the model minority. And so this sociologist, William Peterson, essentially branded Asians, that if you want to be successful, if you want to attain economic success in America, you have to be a model minority. In other words, Sierra, Tango, Foxtrot, Unicorn, you know, and now you all know what I'm saying, but that's essentially what the thing was. And so this allowed and allowed the dominant culture, which at the time was the white culture and still is, but it allowed the dominant culture to essentially pat themselves on the back and to say, look at how we are, we're so socially awoke and we're so socially accepting because we are allowing, they are, in the fact that they use the word allow, but we're allowing this unique discrimination that's faced by the Asian Americans to be justified by the model minority concept. So, so if you all recall this, that I grew up in the era of the yellow peril, of being called the yellow peril, because the Chi-Com myth was stronger than the Russian communist myth. Again, because the Russian communists are white and the Chinese communists are people of color. So you can accept Russian communism and you can understand Russian communism and you can accept refugees from the Russian communist bloc, the USSR, but by golly, you cannot accept refugees from the Chinese communists because they are forever foreigners. They will never, ever, ever be Americans, forever foreigners. And that is the concept that they utilized in order to justify, in order to indoctrinate Americans into believing that people from Asia were always, always beholden to their Asian country, even though they were second or third generations in America, which justified them, what? The Japanese internment camps. Did you see any German internment camps? I did not. Did you?
No.
I don't think so.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But they sure had Japanese internment camps because we are forever foreigners.
Right, right. So when they released those people out of camp, politically, along with William Peterson's articles and the things that he wrote, when they released them, there was a reparation. I think it was $20,000 per Asian, and I guess at that time it was a lot of money. It certainly wasn't enough because every Asian home during that time could give you a story about someone or people that they lost during that terrible time, during that internment time. However, along with reparations, there was something else that was gifted, quotes in place, that was gifted to Asians, and that's when they started the media, I call it a hoax of sorts, but it was a media frenzy that Asians were these brilliant people that came from the East. And so that stuff that Asians about their mental acuity, and it also stuck that they were better. And it was exactly because they were becoming or they were willing to be the model minority. You're absolutely right. And so for that, you were gifted with these particular gifts that said that Asians were a certain way and different from other Asians. I'm talking about other Indians and maybe Moroccans and people like that, and certainly from African Americans. And so that particular mindset, you live up to that. I met a young man in UPS store maybe a year ago in Florida, and I was getting some stuff done, and I saw him. He came out of the back. He was Asian, and I said, oh, I want to know what's up with my phone. And, of course, my prejudice said he would know if nobody in this store knows. So I go over to him. And I said, hi, and we talked, and I said, listen. And I told him about my phone and what I thought. He says, you're going to have to take this to AT&T because I'm not sure that, you know, you do this. And he was trying to help me, but he couldn't. He didn't know it. And so when he didn't know it, I said, oh, well, see, I came over here, and I was doing it in a humorous way. I said, I came over here just to talk to you because I just knew you knew. And he laughed, and he said, you know what? He said, that is so exhausting. I said, what? He said, the fact that people, he said, people stop me in my street, in the street, and ask me technical questions like I'm supposed to know. He said, I don't like school. And I don't, and he just, and it was so hysterical. We actually sat and talked for another half an hour because we began to mix and talk about how we're perceived as people other than white and how, what a caste system it is. You know, there are black people that were actually lighter than him that walked in there. But he just let me know that it is a disparity for me. It is not fun for me to be that person. There's too much. He said it's too much pressure to have to be the best in your class. It's too much. And I really felt his pain. I understood, whether you agree with him or not about his achievements, what I heard and what I really attached myself to was the fact that once you're labeled for the rest of your life, and it's not fair. Black people are labeled with the same types of things, and that's why there are so many medical disparities in our system, because Asian people, Hispanic people who are people of color, not the ones that are white, and certainly African Americans and black people, they are stigmatized to the point where they don't seek out medical care. They don't seek out mental health care to help them with those issues. That young man opened my eyes to something that's so stupid, and that's a prejudice. That's what that was. When I walked over and said, I know he knows, I meant well, but that was prejudice.
Yeah, well, Lee, is he there?
Yes,
Lee?
I am here. How's everyone?
My hubby.
Since the smart females have left us out of the conversation here, I wanted to get you a chance to get in with at least something. It's my show. I can't even talk.
No, you're not supposed
Lee,
to.
Lee, what do you say about this? Now, especially when Lindsey Graham said that I am going to never stop talking. I will talk till I fall over to stop the next voting rights bill. This is what he said. He doesn't want us to have any voting rights. And that's everybody. Every minority.
Well, that's absolutely preposterous because from a psychological standpoint, when we're all human, and so we all ascribe Maslow's hierarchy of needs. There are certain things that we want as people, not as Asians, not as African Americans, or from wherever. You know, we're all human. We have, you know, we want love, we want acceptance, we want security. You know, and they're, you know, the Maslow's hierarchy needs talked about everything that humans want. And so it's preposterous, you know, what he's saying. We all are human, less so than, you know.
Well, you know what he was saying? He was saying that because he said that Strom Thurmond was the last person to do a major talk on a Strom Thurmond was the last person to do a major talk on a to hold up the filibuster. But Strom Thurmond, when he did that, he spoke for 25 hours or 24 hours, but he was 25 years old. Lindsey Graham is over 65. I don't think he's going to talk for 24 hours.
Well,
I think they can modify it to do 24 hours. You got to talk, and when you stop talking, it's the end of the story. Because you can't have multiple people talk. It's got to be one person. That's how it works.
Well, they don't even talk anymore. They just say that they're going to
the Democrats, by a minority vote, can change the rules of the filibuster. To make it, you got to talk until you drop. And then we vote.
And I believe that we should change the filibuster rules because the idea, the theory of democracy is the majority rules.
That's right.
What we have now is we have a minority of the people who are trying to speak for us all so that they can maintain their power base, and that's wrong, you know.
Well, you understand that the filibuster rule was originally in place in order to stop and to prevent the people of color from having a voice,
That's right. You do know that.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
Yes.
That was the only reason why, because it's not in the Constitution anywhere. That was put in there. But the thing
is
that you got to stop, you got to talk, and when you stop, it goes to the vote. And you can't have somebody else say, well, I'm going to take your place. No, one person, that's it.
Well, for those who may be listening, the filibuster is a rule that they put in place to end debate, can't end debate. What happens? You know, the rule, your bill dies. So I mean that, and they did that. I mean, they used it, but they didn't use it. They didn't use it like they do now. They use it that way now so that they can stop debate, so that they can kill bills. They used it in the 60s for the Voting Rights Act.
It's to end debate, but once you stop debating, you got to vote on it. Once you stop debating, you got to vote.
Yeah, just vote on it.
And that's the problem.
Like,
and you only need a minority to win. You don't need 60 votes.
Yeah, it's a rule that helps the minority to have power in the Senate. That's how it was developed.
Right.
But that's wrong because that goes against what the Constitution and everything that we believe, or most people believe the Constitution is about, you know, the majority rules. But they don't want the majority rule because they always have been the minority in the world. I mean, Europeans are not the minority in the world, but they want power. They're the colonizers. You know, there's nothing about their culture that they didn't steal from someone else. I mean, when you look at history, I mean, when Hannibal, you know, conquered Southern Europe, you know, those people didn't even know how to bathe. You know, we taught them how to do the things that they do. You know, so to make it short. It's just racism. It's people who want to maintain power and to control because they feel that they're losing power. And we shouldn't allow that. I mean, the ideals of democracy is that the majority rules, but they don't want that. That's why they're trying to prevent black people and people of color from voting. That's why this guy goes and he kills a bunch of people and they say that he was having a bad day. That's bullshit. Pardon my language. I'm sorry.
As they say in Star Trek, does the need of the many outweigh the need of the few, or does the need of the few outweigh the need of the many?
Michael, you have to be able to govern.
Everybody, don't jump on me all at once. Holy cow, I'm asking a question. That's all I'm doing.
All I'm doing is asking a question. The government is for the majority of the people. You know, what the majority says rules, but they don't like that because they're no longer the majority.
So you're saying the need of the many outweigh the need of the few?
Absolutely.
Uh-huh.
And if they look
at
their history.
Is that what you think? Are you saying that also, Dr. Grace? Do you believe that?
No. No.
Ah.
It depends. The answer is it depends. If it is a public health issue, then yes, because you don't want the one Typhoid Mary to be running around spreading that particular disease. Yes. But in other areas, for example, you know, seeing the needs of the many outweigh that of the few can lead to institutionalized racism and can lead to an excuse for hate crimes and crimes against humanity. So my answer is yes and no.
You're talking like an independent now. I'm on walking the fence.
No, I'm talking like a pragmatist. I'm talking like a scientist. You're such a schmuck, my friend.
Now you see, that's what the need of the many want. You see, that's what they always say.
That's for the people who don't care about people. I don't hate anybody. When my lineage, you know, I've got Asian, African American, and European. So I don't hate anybody. I just hate what Europeans do.
Yeah, but you had no control of that. You weren't even alive. You had no control.
No,
you were born into that. Like, so you would get rid of all those other people if you had control of it?
Well, no, because all humans have value of some sort. You know, when they're right, when they're psychologically right, you know, and they don't hate people.
Yes, but
you see,
who decides when you're right? Who decides when you're right?
Well, democracy is one man, one vote. And we have yet to really experience that because of racism.
One man, not one woman?
The elephant, I'm sorry?
Not one woman?
One person, one vote. You know, I'm using that euphemism, man. But one person, one vote.
It's one woman in my house. It's one woman in my house. I don't know what you're talking about.
Well, there's only one woman in mine. But my point is that we're dealing with people who don't know how to govern. They don't follow the Constitution. So it would certainly, as it drips down, would be ambiguous to us. The needs of the many outweighing the needs of the few. This country was almost a capitalistic oligarchy, because that's what your citizen Trump wanted, was an oligarchy. And so if they knew how to govern, we might not mind. So I understand what Dr. Gracie is talking about, but if racism is the elephant in the room, and that's not going anywhere as long as they can cast us. And so we have to have democracy, this great experiment called democracy, where at least the majority rules. I don't know about the needs of the many. I think that it's just majority rules. And they're not willing to work for a majority. They're not willing to encourage Asians and Indians and African Americans to join their party, because they really don't want that. They really don't. They're not trying to work. All they're doing is attempting to use whatever little bit of power that they have, and especially this group of people, 70,000 people in this country, who were racist before Trump came on, to follow their lead. And following their lead will give them power enough to do what they want to do, not to do for this country. It'd be different if they said, we know how to lead, and we want to do this for this country. We just have different ways of getting there, but we're both thinking on the same term. That is not so. We have an enemy. We have treasonous people who are sitting in our legislature. So it's not about, it's about majority rule. And because the people who have our best interests at heart on a general level are in power, instead of working like we do and canvassing and going door to door and putting out your ideology and being proud of it, they don't have anything to be proud of. And so because they won't do that, they're doing it in another way. They're using something called a filibuster.
I agree with you, but you see, they're not actually the majority. They're a small minority which acts like they're the majority. That's the difference.
You left out one thing, Michael.
Yes.
They don't believe in government. You know,
No, they don't. That's the second portion of it. But in order to be majority rule, you have to be the majority. But they're not the majority. They're only like 30% or less. But they want to control the majority, saying they are the majority, but they're not the majority. So what we need to do is we need to really figure out who the majority actually is.
Well, we know it's not them.
Who are the majority, Dr. Grace?
Well, if you're talking raw numbers, then certainly the white folk are not in the majority. But if you are talking about power, then yes, they are. And the unfortunate thing is, and that's where the rubber hits the road, right? That's where we have to be, and that's where we have to be very cognizant.
Right. So
when
they say majority, they're talking about who has the power. That's the majority they're talking about. They're not talking about the numbers of people. They're talking about who has the power.
Yep.
These people have the power. So therefore, we are in control of everything. Now, should it be that way? Just because you got more power than anybody else? No.
Well, of course not. Well, of course not. But there's the but again.
That's right. There's
but this historically has been the way the white culture has run itself. Okay.
Yes.
Spain came over to South America and dominated pretty much all of South America except for Brazil, where Portugal came in and took that one. But Spain came in and took out took Latin America and South America. And they did it by genocide. They did it by introducing smallpox and syphilis and other diseases that could wipe out and did wipe out entire communities of Native Americans, the Native, Latin Americans and South Americans. And that's how they destroyed them. They destroyed a beautiful Inca culture that way, too, and Aztecs and Mayans, and they destroyed the Native Americans in North Carolina that way as well, not to mention the Inuits in Alaska. But why the hell they wanted to go to Alaska when it's so freaking cold, I have no idea, except for the fact that, we have nothing else to do. And then they found gold. Okay, then.
Oh, yeah.
So,
hey. Yeah. That works.
So
that works.
It's been a history of this. And then of course, let's not talk about how Christianity has played a role in the hatred, the hate mongering.
Hell no. Listen, I had Jesuits in school. I know how they were. They were hate mongering when I was in school. So
I had Jesuits and I had Sisters of the Holy Infant. And, they made you say Holy Infant a few times.
this is just like there's a TV series on which I never started watching until about 6 months ago. My daughter got me involved in it called The Snowpiercer. And that's exactly how it's set up. Those that have run the show, those that don't, you got everything that's left.
Yep.
And they let the people on board the train who didn't have anything, but you had to stay in the back compartments and you ate what we gave you. You just keep the train running. Because we have the money and we're one of the sponsors. So therefore, just do what we say. And I have
that question that will. Where did they get the stuff, Michael?
Where did they get the what? The wealth?
Where did they get their wealth?
They got their wealth by stealing.
They stole it. They got the wealth by stealing the natural resources of each country where they came and planted their flag. You know, America, the Native Americans had no idea that they didn't even exist until the white man came and discovered them.
That's right.
Can you believe that?
They stole that you now exist? Holy cow, Batman. I can't believe it. You didn't know.
They finally got discovered.
Most of them don't even know. You know, look at Los Angeles. Los Angeles was founded by a group of black Mexicans. You know, most people don't know that, but if you do your research, I mean, Los Angeles was founded by a group of black of Mexicans of African descent, but they don't recognize that. You know, it's, you know, because of their racism.
Didn't Trump say that he was that they were going to pay for the wall? I guess they did tell him they weren't, huh?
Yeah.
That man is an idiot. You know, he knows nothing. His people said he knows nothing. I mean, all he was trying to them to be racist openly. That's all he was. That's why we're where we are right now.
Well,
you know, the very day of the Atlanta shooting, Trump was on Fox TV calling it the China virus.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Again.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, but he didn't say
100th time, 150th time.
He didn't say that an American pharmaceutical company had the patent for the viruses that are what is now COVID, you know. They have no culture. We gave them their culture.
Well,
they have the riches because it all came from Africa and Asia. You know, that's why Genghis Khan talked about Asiatic black men.
Yes.
Because Asians and Africans have been in solidarity from a business perspective for millennia.
Absolutely. Well, ladies and gentlemen, I need to move on. I got something that I'm playing from Michael Cohen, and I need to get this underway. And I'm getting my left knee removed and replaced on April the 6th, so I'll be completely bionic from the, well, not completely bionic from waist down, but from the kneecaps down. Let's put it that way. But anyway.
The current knees and joints are so much better than the ones that they've had in the past, so you should do very well.
Yeah, well, my right one did pretty good, so, hey, there's the left one now. But I want to thank you. Oh, we dropped, Dr. Grace dropped. And Diane, I'll see you later. And Lee, I guess I'll see you too, on Zoom, that is, because we still can't go face. Have you had your shot yet?
I'm scheduled for March 25th to get my first
Okay,
Pfizer.
I had both mine already. Got both mine. And I feel pretty safe going to the hospital now. I wasn't going to do that until after I got these both done. Now that I have done, I feel great. So anyway, we have a great show coming up next. It's Michael Cohen, and he is going to be talking some shit on the air about you know who. And I see that he now just came back from seeing the Manhattan DA again for the 8th time. So, and I saw that Dr. Weisselberg, his ex-daughter-in-law, says they got some stuff on Mr. You-Know-Who, the orange man who was formerly in the White House. Anyway, all right, everybody, thanks for being on, Diane and Lee, and we are now going to hear from Mr. Hey, you got to hear this from Michael Cohen, at least the beginning. He is so fantastic. I'm telling you, just listen to this.
Michael Cohen, and you're listening to the Mea Culpa podcast. On Friday came news that California Representative Eric Swalwell, who led House impeachment efforts against Donald Trump, has become the latest plaintiff to sue the former president for his role in inciting the Capitol insurrection. The lawsuit aims to hold Trump, as well as his son Don Trump Jr., Rudy Giuliani, and Representative Mo Brooks of Alabama, accountable for inflaming tensions ahead of the January 6th riot.
We are now learning this morning that former President Trump is being sued by one of the impeachment managers, Eric Swalwell, filing the civil suit against not just the former president, but his son, Donald Trump Jr., Congressman Mo Brooks, Rudy Giuliani as well.
Swalwell's lawsuit follows one delivered by the NAACP on behalf of Representative Benny Thompson, which marvelously was served to Trump at his Mar-a-Lago residence last week. Just like Thompson's suit, Swalwell cites the 1871 Ku Klux Klan Act, created to protect lawmakers from violence and intimidation. But Swalwell's suit, which was filed in the United States District Court in Washington, D.C. by the law firm Kaiser Dillon, goes further and accuses Trump and his key allies of breaking anti-terrorism laws, aiding and abetting violent rioters, and intentionally inflicting severe emotional distress on lawmakers who were at the Capitol that day.
The analogy would be a defendant in a criminal case being found not guilty by a jury and then being sued civilly for essentially the same conduct. It happens a lot. It happened with O.J. Simpson, for example. And that's essentially what we're looking at now. If the civil courts is the right forum, we're here, and we're going to take this case, and we're going to bring it before a judge and a jury, and we're going to have the merits adjudicated that way.
The complaint alleges, as a direct and foreseeable consequence of the defendant's false and incendiary allegations of fraud and theft, and in direct response to the defendant's expressed calls for violence at the rally, a violent mob attacked the U.S. Capitol. Swalwell is also seeking unspecified financial damages from Trump's role in inciting the riot and is demanding Trump provide written notice 7 days in advance of a rally or public event hosted in Washington on an important election day.
It says that the siege was a direct and foreseeable consequence of the months of claims by Mr. Trump and the others in the lawsuit that the election was stolen. They all spoke at the rally, all those who were sued before the riot, and the lawsuit says they whipped up the crowd for violence, like a similar lawsuit filed last month by Congressman Benny Thompson of Mississippi and the NAACP. This one also invokes a federal civil rights law that allows lawsuits against government officials for claims that they conspired to violate civil rights.
Swalwell's lawsuit paints a much fuller picture of Trump's actions before and after the event. Drawing on House impeachment manager's case against the former president, suing under a wider theory of negligence. The suit does not focus on extremists who planned for violence, but the many more who were there for a political rally before the defendants and others alleged whipped them into a frenzy and turned them into violent mob that participated in the attack. Once again, Trump, who has long used the courts as a cudgel against his enemies, is getting it back in spades with this lawsuit, treating him like a nuisance that he is, and also seeking punitive damage that could create disastrous financial problems for the former president. The strategy here with these civil suits is death by a thousand cuts. If Trump couldn't be impeached wholesale and prevented from holding office, these lawsuits will make him a full-time defendant, eating away at his personal liberty and his pocketbook until the criminal trials can begin. The lawsuit concludes the defendants, in short, convinced the mob that something was occurring that, if actually true, might indeed justify violence, and then sent the mob to the Capitol with violence-laced calls for immediate action. Ironically, it was left to Trump's lowlife spokesman and hooker enthusiast Jason Miller, who has his own well-recorded history with the courts, to provide response to Swalwell's suit, telling the Washington Post, Eric Swalwell is a lowlife with no credibility.
I didn't get a harumph out of that guy.
The federal investigation into the January 6th riot is moving it slowly but methodically, with new information revealed daily about the origins of the insurrection or the people responsible for its derivation. Now comes news that the FBI has arrested the first actual Trump administration political appointee, 42-year-old Federico Klein, for his role in the storming of the Capitol. An FBI lookout bulletin issued 2 weeks after the Capitol assault included a picture of Klein, prompting an anonymous tipster to contact the FBI and finger him as the man in the photograph, according to an affidavit filed in federal court in Washington.
According to the FBI affidavit, as of January 6th, the day that this all went down, insurrection, Klein also had an active top secret security clearance. That same 16-page FBI affidavit published today by the New York Times reveals that Klein was present in some of the most grisly, violent, upsetting scenes at the Capitol on January 6th.
Video from police worn body cameras on January 6th shows Klein jamming a riot shield into doors at the Capitol as police were trying to secure them to keep the mob out. Klein was also heard on video trying to encourage others to fight with the police, yelling, "We need fresh people! We need fresh people!" Klein shouted repeatedly while seemingly acting out some latent Rambo fantasy he was unable to exercise from his psyche during paintball or Call of Duty.
We need fresh patriots! We need fresh
seems to have been a mid-level Trump campaign associate. I certainly never knew him during my time on the campaign. He's just another brainwashed MAGA schmuck who ruined his own life in service to the big lie and fat-ass Donald Trump.
And body camera footage shows that Klein himself pushed his way to the front of the crowd. That is a Trump administration official in the mob pushing his way to the front of the crowd, physically and verbally engaging with officers attempting to stop the invasion.
Klein worked on the 2016 campaign and was then hired at the State Department. He is charged with several felonies, including assault on police officers, interfering with police during civil disorder, and obstruction of an official proceeding, as well as lesser offenses. While a relative nobody in the Trump apparatus, Klein's arrest nonetheless brings the insurrection into the administration. Where it stops now is the ultimate question. Klein will likely be pressured to rat on his associates, and the FBI will begin chasing this up the ladder. And here we go, folks.
The FBI is investigating whether foreign governments, groups, or individuals may have funded extremists who helped plan and execute the January 6th attack. FBI sources telling NBC News that the Bureau is examining payments of $500,000 in Bitcoin, apparently by a French national, to key figures and groups in the alt-right before the riot. It's kind of weird.
Let's now shed a tear for those lowly Senate clerks who were forced into extra duty by Wisconsin Senator Ron Johnson of Wisconsin. In some misguided attempt at irony or owning the libs, as these folks like to say, Johnson had the clerks read out loud all 628 pages of the coronavirus stimulus bill, 100,000 words in all. It was a lame stunt aimed at registering his objections to the bill while using the Senate's arcane rules to delay debate on the bill.
I don't want to sound like a leftist, but I'm going to resist. Okay, so the first way I'm going to resist is I'm going to go down and object to the waiving of the reading of the bill. I will make them read their 600 to 700 page bill.
Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer accused Johnson of going to ridiculous lengths to show his opposition to the package, saying it will accomplish little more than a few sore throats for the Senate clerks who work very hard day in, day out to help the Senate function. Johnson, who is a dead ringer for George Costanza's boss from Kruger Industrial Smoothing on Seinfeld, defended his actions as necessary. But this guy is a total fucking asshole. The clerks finished at 2.04 a.m. after an 11-hour delay, allowing the bill to proceed into debate as required and accomplishing abso-fucking-lutely nothing.
Well, for real people, this is every minute, every hour. It means people are going hungry. It means they're getting further behind on their rent. They're worried about losing their car. This has already taken far, far too long. And I think in addition to the very, very human consequences, including for seniors, for children, there's also the fact that these kinds of procedural maneuvers really do shake the American people's confidence in government, which has already been badly shaken by the fact that the Senate, from March until the end of December, really took no action at all to deliver help with this pandemic to the American people.
This is where we have sunk with the GOP. Their ability to weaponize the arcane rules of the Senate to wreak fucking havoc on the political process is well known during the post-election certification crisis. But this nonsense is next level obnoxious. They have become a party of trolls and nothing more.
But on the real though, this is not just petty, it's disgusting. And on top of that, I'd respect him maybe a little bit more if he read the bill himself. But instead, this bitch is making some poor clerk read it. Like, you don't get to act like you're some heroic resistor if someone else is doing the work.
Now let's talk about Andrew Cuomo. We are equal opportunity here at Mea Culpa in our search for the truth and our desire to expose the hypocrisy and criminality of the political system wherever it leads. While the majority of the show is spent on Donald Trump and his inner circle, we still live by the credo of nothing but the truth. Besides, Cuomo is a fascinating and flawed human being who is entertaining to watch in his operatic desperation to be admired and adored.
Growing fallout for New York Governor Andrew Cuomo and his administration over withholding COVID death toll numbers in nursing homes. The growing scrutiny comes just weeks after New York Attorney General Letitia James released a report claiming the state had undercounted nursing home deaths by as much as 50%. State health officials acknowledged the death toll was more than 15,000, much higher than originally reported.
The top Cuomo aide admitted withholding data for months over concerns the Trump Justice Department might use the info against them.
Those comments sparked immediate backlash among lawmakers on both sides of the aisle.
State Republicans going so far as to say he should be impeached.
He possesses many of the same sociopathic traits as the Donald, and the Cuomos themselves go all the way back to Queens with the Trumps. Their mothers were friendly with one another. But this isn't a story about the Cuomos and the Trumps. We're here to talk about Andrew Cuomo and his own sociopathy.
I know it was you, Fredo. You broke my heart.
Last spring, as New York City suffered through the worst of COVID and the city became a morgue, Cuomo's daily pressers became a form of collective therapy for the city and appointment viewing for the rest of the country. That they were often opposite Trump's own COVID task force pressers drove the former president fucking insane. And Cuomo, no shrinking violet in the bully department, was able to shove it back in Trump's face to the glee of traumatized television watchers everywhere.
What are you going to grant me what the Constitution gave me before you were born? It's called the 10th Amendment. I didn't need the President of the United States to tell me that I'm governor. And I didn't need the President of the United States to tell me the powers of a state.
Twitter lit up with love letters to Cuomo, and the media wondered aloud why he was not running against Trump instead of Joe Biden. Here was the Donald's rhetorical equal, a man unafraid to punch back. But Cuomo never seriously considered running, nor did the DNC do much to encourage this line of thinking either. Why not? because they knew, as did a lot of folks, that Cuomo was good at playing wartime consigliere.
What do you think, this is the army where you shoot them a mile away? You gotta get up close like this, and bada-bing, you blow their brains all over your nice Ivy League suit.
But in his closet lurked a truckload of skeletons. There was just something a little off about him. Now, I'm not talking about the nipple rings or incessant self-regard and long-winded monologues, but there was this constant whisper that the guy was just sort of wrong.
I never touched anyone inappropriately. I never touched anyone inappropriately. I now understand that I acted in a way that made people feel uncomfortable.
Fine for New York State, but under the microscope of a national campaign, things would emerge. And emerge they have. First was the nursing home scandal and the reported purposeful undercounting of deaths. Cuomo attempted to brush it off by saying he did it to prevent Trump from weaponizing those statistics during the campaign. Then there was this creepy behavior towards women, harassment, and unwanted advances.
This morning, New York Governor Andrew Cuomo facing new calls for resignation after a third woman has come forward with accusations of sexual harassment. Anna Rook telling the New York Times the governor tried to kiss her at a New York City wedding reception in 2019 and then sharing this photograph she says was captured on her cell phone that night by a friend. Rook saying that when Governor Cuomo put his hand on her bare lower back, she, quote, promptly removed his hand with my hand. According to the paper, the governor remarked that she seemed aggressive and placed his hands on her cheeks. He asked if he could kiss her.
Finally, the Wall Street Journal is reporting that those COVID deaths were undercounted and delayed earlier than previously thought. Aides have admitted now to rewriting reports from the New York Health Department as early as last June. Cuomo, it seems, was eager to tout the state's success in handling the pandemic and was in the midst of writing a book on the subject entitled American Crisis that positioned him as the hero of COVID, uniquely qualified to lead the state through its darkest hour.
This morning, growing political fallout for New York Governor Andrew Cuomo.
We needed honesty and clarity, not confusion and evasiveness.
And many of us on both sides of this aisle have deep concerns.
State lawmakers voted Friday to revoke the emergency powers he was granted last year to handle the COVID crisis. This comes amid new reports from the New York Times and Wall Street Journal claiming his top aides altered a nursing home report to undercount and obscure the true death toll numbers.
Reading it now, in light of all of what has happened, has been a cringeworthy exercise in schadenfreude. But now independent investigators are leaning into the episode, and New York Attorney General Tish James has gotten involved. The knives are out for Cuomo. How this all shakes out is anybody's guess, but we'll keep watching.
Did you not miss it?
For the main event. Last week's security threat at the Capitol put our current domestic terror threat into stark and urgent terms. While we may snicker and laugh at the intent of these groups as they plot to reinstall Donald Trump as president, they themselves are deadly serious. We are at a moment in time, not unlike the post 9/11 period, where we must figure out how to respond to the threat. My persistent fear is that January 6th was just the beginning and that we are looking at a future where extremist violence and domestic terror becomes the number one threat to this nation. In order to better understand the preconditions to how we got to this place and better understand where we are headed, I reached out to Spencer Ackerman, senior national security correspondent for the Daily Beast. His reporting on the January 6th insurrection and its aftermath has been appointment reading for me during this extraordinary moment. Prior to the Daily Beast, Ackerman was part of a team of reporters and editors at the Guardian newspaper who received the Pulitzer for their work on Edward Snowden and his whistleblowing activities related to the NSA. In addition, Ackerman wrote the upcoming book, Reign of Terror, for Penguin Random House, which will be in stores this August, and charts the profound impact that the war on terror had in pushing American politics and society in an authoritarian direction. Now that we are headed into a war on domestic terror, Ackerman's book is more relevant than ever, and I'm lucky to have his perspective on mea culpa. One of the thesis points for your book, Reign of Terror, is pinned atop your Twitter feed, and you write, explanations for how the U.S. reached its nationalist moment have overlooked something, the war on terror. Its generation-long brutality has left a toxic political legacy. Can you explain, please, to my listeners in what way this toxic political legacy led to the election of Donald Trump in the first place?
Sure thing, Michael, and thank you so much for inviting me on your podcast. This was not something I expected. I've been looking forward to it all week. And to get right into that, this is a conversation I'm very interested in getting your reactions to, not just as someone who was, you know, for so long in the Trump orbit, but just as, you know, if I'm not misunderstanding, we are two native New Yorkers, correct?
That is correct. You were from where?
I'm from Flatbush, Brooklyn.
Oh, sure.
Where I still live.
Oh, interesting. My mom went to Midwood. And I was actually born in
I was born
in the Brooklyn Hospital on DeKalb Avenue. Know the area quite well.
Certainly well enough, unlike a lot of people, to pronounce it correctly, with the correct inflection. Anyway, you asked about Reign of Terror. So, as a native New Yorker, you will, of course, remember the trauma, the horror and the outrage that resulted from 9/11. And what I think has become much clearer in retrospect is how powerful political figures at the beginning in the Republican Party, but always with the acquiescence out of fear of the Democratic Party, channeled that very real, very robust and very raw trauma into what I think we can fairly call a psychotic period in American foreign policy. A period where, on the one hand, the mechanisms of national security are spun up with new purpose and new direction, but not with new focus. And on a different level, a very raw feeling of besiegement and of anger was able to be channeled very easily into a culture war. And that culture war initially targeted Muslims. It initially treated immigrants not as a source of, you know, more Americans, but as a source of national danger. And these two strands, the policy level and the cultural level, feed on each other in such a way after the wars deteriorate into things that the United States can't win, in such a way that they start looking for other targets. They start looking for targets closer to home, and they start coming up with explanations for why the U.S. can't, as such a supremely powerful nation, can't get out of this circumstance, that start leaning into kind of civilizational explanations, that this ultimately is a war against Islam, that it has nothing to do with the dominant position of American foreign policy and how such dominance throughout history, whoever does it, always breeds resistance. Some of that resistance will take the form of religiously inspired resistance. And particularly over the Obama years, which is kind of the meat of my book, Reign of Terror, you start seeing this, what I like to call a decadent phase of the war on terror, after it seems the wars can't be won themselves. Obama decides after the Osama bin Laden raid not to declare this era over and start unwinding some of the emergency powers, if not all of the emergency powers that were passed after 9/11, into this sense that results as there's always another explanation for who is stopping the United States from winning, that it becomes this person in the White House who, you know, mysteriously, by being the first African-American president, attracts a lot of racist conspiracy theories. It's important that we recognize that one of those conspiracy theories, the principal one, in fact, birtherism, the one that your former boss spread, if not, you know, acting as the supreme practitioner of it, is itself a creation of the war on terror, because it's not just that he's black, it's not just that he is, which he was not, allegedly foreign and Kenyan, but that he was Muslim. And the problem, supposedly, the thing that's sort of lurking in the subtext, if not particularly subtly, of birtherism, is that there is an enemy of the United States at a time of war in the White House, and he is why the United States can't seem to win the war on terror. And then the longer that this happens, as long as these two dynamics, the policy dynamic, the political dynamic, the cultural dynamic, feed on one another, it becomes, I believe, and I will, you know, endeavor to show in this book, inevitable that whether it was Trump, whether it would have been someone else, someone would have been able to walk through this very open door, this door that's open to nativism now, that also allows, as we saw during the Trump administration, but also during earlier administrations, demagogues who want to use the mechanisms, the architecture, the weapons of the war on terror in places like Portland, where you saw the Department of Homeland Security stuffing people into vans, things that immigrants, since DHS had been around, had been rather used to. And you start seeing the way these dynamics feed upon themselves in really disturbing ways. By the way, that's not to say the right has no critique of the war on terror that isn't worth listening to. There have been anti-war voices on the right that have spoken up about it quite frequently. The thing that I also try and explore in the book is how much of those sort of fed the other nationalist and nativist purposes, the anti-immigrant crusade and the anti-Muslim crusade. So that's sort of the way, in a nutshell, even though that might not have been a nutshell, the book kind of takes its critique. And I'm very curious what you saw up close and personal as all of this happened in the Trump circle.
Well, I can really speak, because I was there at the time of the birtherism between Trump and his hatred for Barack Obama. His hatred for Barack Obama was predicated upon two things. First and foremost, actually, let's make it three. First and foremost is the fact that he's black. The second is the fact that he's brilliant. And that's something that Donald Trump has a problem with, because he realizes his own inadequacies. And then the third, which really drove Trump crazy, was the fact that Barack Obama was wildly popular, especially outside of the United States. I'll never forget sitting in Trump's office when we spoke about Barack Obama in Germany, and there must have been about a million people lining up that gigantic mall and applauding for him and truly excited to see the first black American president. And that really pissed Trump off, something that I, to this day, I can't exactly explain why, other than the fact that it's just his own lack of self, and that Trump needs to be adored and jeered by people in order to give him his own self-worth, something that really he's just missing, and he's missing terribly. But I wanted also to bring up to you, Spencer, that just this morning, Capitol Police had to shut down Congress after intelligence agencies picked up a whole slew of chatter about a possible March 4th attack from followers of QAnon, who believed that the day to be, meaning today, that Donald Trump would supposedly be returned to the presidency and basically arrest all of his corrupt opponents. Discuss this latest threat with me and what your sources are saying.
All I can really tell you is that you heard in the January 6th hearings yesterday in the Senate, the Department of Homeland Security and the FBI, the FBI sent their senior counterterrorism official, talking nebulously, talking kind of around the thing at issue for a variety of reasons that we can get into, to say that they take this prospect very seriously. that they don't see, with Trump out of office, a diminution in the danger of domestic violence, right-wing and white supremacist terrorism. They don't want to talk as national security officials about political issues, right? They don't want to say the reason why this is happening is because you have this movement that a former president of the United States built, stoked, maintains, and kind of wants to believe will carry him back into power. Now, if you think my interpretation is wrong, you just jump in and stop it. But one of the things that also stuck out during these hearings was that the FBI in particular is making a point of saying that as the pool of charges from January 6th starts expanding, that we've seen something now like, I think it's 270 people charged federally, some more, I think it gets to about 300 when local law enforcement gets involved. But what both Christopher Wray, the director of the FBI, and Jill Sanborn, the senior FBI counterterrorism official, said is that you are starting to see more and more militias be found within the pool of charges, more militia members, and apparently this will be more forthcoming, a question about the degree to which there was real command and control pre-planned elements that went into January 6th. You know, people showed up with communication gear, people showed up with improvised weapons. There were bombs at the DNC and the RNC that we still don't know who set off. There have been no arrests in that. And it looks like those very volatile elements aren't going away, and that seems to be what's, you know, at stake on, we're recording this today, March 4th and perhaps beyond. Also, there's kind of the bureaucratic cover-your-ass element of it after you know, these hearings are going on the presumption that the security state was found flat-footed on January 6th, and now they certainly don't want to say, we have no indication that it'll be, you know, a serious threat on March 4th and beyond. But if I could just say one more thing. One of the reasons that I'm glad you brought up this QAnon threat and the threat from violence of it right after asking me about in my book is because one of the other real important aspects of the post 9/11 era, and one that I deal with extensively in my book Reign of Terror, which is forthcoming in August from Viking, and if anyone wants to pre-order that, I'd really appreciate that from them, is the fact that all throughout the war on terror are very, very large falsehoods, if not outright lies. That, you know, for instance, that we didn't torture people, we only used, quote, enhanced interrogation techniques on them. And if so, it was absolutely necessary to find bin Laden and so on and so forth, that Iraq was tied with al-Qaeda, that weapons of mass destruction were, you know, to be found in stockpile by Saddam Hussein, ready to be given to al-Qaeda and so on and so forth. A lot of the same people who had a lot of problems with the large lies that Donald Trump told in office were people in the security state who helped stoke other very large lies throughout the war on terror. People like Michael Hayden from the CIA and the National Security Agency, people like John Brennan at the CIA. So I just wanted to point out that, you know, legacy conspiracy theories that kind of drive the nation into different narrative corners, questioning the building blocks of a shared reality and the delta between what they're seeing, what people who they look at as validators say, and trying to make sense of this whole thing. A lot of the unraveling of the truth in the United States kind of at scale, particularly when social media gets involved, is, you know, happens sort of shortly after the start of the 9/11 era. A lot of this stuff really traces in very direct and sometimes ironic ways into the post 9/11 era. And my book talks about that a whole lot.
Well, that makes perfect sense. And one of the things I don't fully understand is we've watched Donald Trump lie to the American people from prior to even him becoming the nominee for the Republican Party. And yet for some unknown reason, people accept his lies. They just sweep it under the rug. Yeah, but that's only Donald Trump. But this is what Donald Trump is trying to say. No, That's wrong. It's not what he's trying to say, and they don't understand, like I do, the code that Donald Trump is talking. He knows what he's saying. He knows how he's stoking it. Now, not every one of the people there on January 6th at the insurrection knew exactly what Trump was talking about, because it's unique to what's in their mind and what they want Donald Trump's words, which are, you know, they're not to the point that he's telling you what he wants. He's giving you enough latitude to make it into what you want. Yeah. So whatever your worst inclination is, that's the words that you're going to accept from Trump, and you're going to act on it. Now, the insurrection, as I've stated many, many times on television and in the press, Donald Trump knew what he was doing. And he knew when he told them, I will be meeting you at the Capitol. He knew that he didn't want them to disperse, that he wanted them to enter into the Capitol. Now, people will turn around and say, yeah, but he didn't want them to go in. He didn't want them to attack, the police officers. He didn't want them to hang Mike Pence or kill Nancy Pelosi, which the truth is he probably did want that. But when he turned around and he stated, I will meet you at the Capitol, that to me was the single most important line of the insurrection. He knew that by saying that, he would move the crowd from where they were to where he wanted them to be. And his prayer was that they were going to stop the vote, that he would be reinstated as president, and that ultimately he would become the autocrat or the monarch that he so desperately wants to be.
So in the book, one of the things that I try and, demonstrate, I say that Donald Trump is the perfect lagging indicator of the war on terror, that it was inevitable that the war on terror would produce someone like this. I think that, from everything you're saying, it speaks to what I think is truly Trump's, like, to be cold-blooded about it, real political talent. Demagoguery is a skill. It's something that you really have to perfect. He has a really natural tendency toward it. I suspect it's because, his whole, public career has been one of media manipulation, portraying a leader, on The Apprentice and so on and so forth, someone that people compete to please. You would know a whole lot more about this dynamic than I would. But, you see throughout history, this is the case with fascist and nativist movements, with a charismatic leader, really throughout history, throughout, Europe, South America, and so forth, where there's always wiggle room for the followers to absolve, the great man of culpability when it is convenient for that absolution to happen, and then simultaneously give him credit for the thing they want to valorize when it's convenient for that credit to be bestowed. One of the things that, I've always kind of wanted to ask, and here we are having this conversation, and you stop me if you don't want me to ask you questions, but which is a weird thing for a journalist to say, but it's your podcast, and it's your house, so we'll see. Do you think Trump believed birtherism, or do you think he saw that it was a convenient way of kind of communicating to what would become his followers that they would have a champion in him, someone who would reflect, refine, and empower their agenda?
Yeah, so I'm not now speaking from opinion. I'm speaking from fact. He knew that Barack Obama was not born in Kenya. And he was looking for any information, and there was something in a bibliography from some Harvard paper that had it, that he was from Kenya. He knew for a fact that Barack Obama was an American citizen. When he turned around and made statements to the press, and I was sitting there in the office when he said, watch this shit. Tomorrow it's going to be all over the front page. He goes, just watch this, Michael. And he turned around and he told the press that he had sent a whole slew of investigators who have a lot of information, and soon I will be releasing it about Barack Obama's true place of birth. It was a lie. He knew it was a lie. I knew it was a lie. The only people that didn't know that it was a lie was the media, which then ultimately became the United States population, or I should say the Trump supporters. And that's really sad when one psychopath, a sociopath, a narcissistic sociopath like Donald Trump can manipulate the media with such a with such simplicity and ease, and then basically he adorned every newspaper the following day. Donald Trump sends investigators off, you know, to Hawaii to prove Barack Obama's true place of birth. It was really disgusting, but he realized that it was a popularist view by a segment of this country, and he intended on exploring it. But Spencer, let me just keep moving forward here, because yet in a March 3rd piece for the Daily Beast, you wrote about how bureaucratic restrictions and public relations concerns from the Army and top Trump administration Pentagon appointees unreasonably restrained the D.C. National Guard from responding to the January 6th Capitol insurrection. Can you unpack for me what you believe the truth to be and why the National Guard was held back? And I bring up this question because I lived in D.C. for 4 years when I attended American University. And then I worked actually in the Rayburn Building for Congressman Joe Moakley in 87 and 88. And I'll tell you something, I love that building. And I'll tell you what I loved the most about it was the openness that as an American citizen, you could basically go anywhere that you wanted. You wanted to walk into the Capitol, you could walk into the Capitol. It's our home. The only place, of course, you couldn't is the White House. But you don't have what you have now, which are these prison gates. And I know from prison, these prison gates that are guarded by national security and everywhere. It takes away the beauty of Washington. It takes away the beauty of these magnificent buildings. And why? Because of these insurrectionists, because of Donald Trump's, you know, whistleblowing. But go back to me. What do you believe the truth to be as to why the National Guard was held back?
So I'm a reporter. I don't want to say what I believe the truth to be before, like, we have really a, you know, sufficient amount of evidence to determine that. But I will walk you through the evidence as it's coming in now, and people can draw kind of their own conclusions here. What that story was about was probably the most dramatic testimony given yet across what's now the third hearing into what happened on January 6th. And this came from the commanding general of the D.C. National Guard, who talked about unreasonable restrictions that the Trump-appointed defense secretary, acting defense secretary, Chris Miller, and the Secretary of the Army, Ryan McCarthy, put on him. And what he was, you know, trying to say, you know, in a couple different ways was, first, we were never under this kind of restriction during the Black Lives Matter protests in Washington in June, where Trump got the National Guard onto the street, demanded it, really. And secondly, that when it came to January 6th, throughout the whole afternoon, as, you know, General Walker, like everyone else, is watching this unfold live on television, he is trying to get his chain of command to just let him do what would ultimately be an 18-minute trip with over 150 guardsmen out of the D.C. Armory and through the Capitol to relieve the Metro Police. And the amount of restriction placed on him is something he said no one ever explained to him. So he didn't have a lot of, you know, willingness to speculate about it, about what held it back. Instead, what he did was he just very methodically laid out the timeline of what happened from, I believe it was around like 1:37, when the head of the Capitol Police, Steve Sund, calls him up and says, like, we need immediate assistance. He gets told the day before by a letter from the acting defense secretary, Chris Miller, that he can't use, like, not just any weaponry, but even any personal protective gear, you know, helmets, riot shields, you know, that sort of thing isn't even available to them. And then it takes the better part of the entire day, I shouldn't say the entire day, but 3 hours and 19 minutes before all the restrictions are cleared away. There's an amazing moment where the DOD schmuck, the guy they had testify from the Defense Department who wasn't there at the time, but is basically like collecting the stories. Neither Miller nor McCarthy was there. I imagine it's just a matter of time before they have to testify. The guy says that, A, they were concerned because they got a lot of criticism for, you know, the heavy-handed, you know, guard and other response against Black Lives Matter in June. So, you know, they were overwhelmingly concerned about avoiding that. So that's kind of heads I win, tails you lose if you're the Trump people in that circumstance. But also that even after Miller finally gives the order and, like, clears away the restrictions, that happens that day at apparently 4:32 p.m., according to the Defense Department's own testimony, but General Walker isn't told he can actually deploy until 5:08. And they ask him, you know, you're from the Defense Department, how do you even explain that discrepancy? And the guy answers, Senator, it's an issue. So they don't even have their answers yet.
We often talk about on this show about what we believe would have happened had this insurrection been Black Lives Matter. We often talk about it and the amount of carnage you would have seen left in the street. Something that is just very funny is I was talking to Ali Velshi on the show, and then after the show, I speak to him on a regular basis, and he had told me that he was there that day, and he got shot in the frickin' neck. And he goes, I will tell you, Michael, that frickin' that rubber bullet really, really hurts. You know, he goes, it knocked the wind out of me. And I could only imagine that if this insurrection was based upon Black Lives Matter, the number of bodies that would have been left on the streets, it would have been something fierce. I truly don't understand it.
Well, I would also just quickly say that, like, A, having, like, been out, you know, with some of the Black Lives Matter protests this summer, like, I saw what the reaction was, and absolutely, it would have been, you know, a total bloodbath. Second of all, Black Lives Matter isn't trying to storm the Capitol and overthrow the government and overturn a democratic election. So, like, let's just make a point of saying that outright. There's a lot of equivalences, even well-meaning ones like the one you're trying to make, that I still feel kind of take this debate in a direction that it doesn't need to go. But beyond that, the point that General Walker tried to make was that if he didn't have these restrictions placed on him, he believes that, like, early in the 2 o'clock hour, the National Guard could have made it to the Capitol and pushed the insurrection back, strengthened the Capitol police line, and hopefully, like, stopped the breach, or, like, you know, maybe only a couple people instead of, I believe, an estimated, like, 800, like a battalion's worth of people end up in there. So that was something, you know, he didn't want to get into what was sort of the specter hanging around the whole hearing, which was, what was the relationship between Trump ordering, like, people, as you mentioned, it's not quite ordering isn't the right word, but certainly inciting people to go there. And you had people like Ted Cruz and Josh
Hawley. And Don Trump Jr. and Rudy Giuliani, all basically stoking the fire. You know, Spencer, I want to also bring up, because we were talking about the FBI, and yesterday you tweeted about the FBI's bungling of intelligence reports prior to January 6th, and you wrote, and I quote, "They want to say the FBI didn't miss warnings about January 6th, despite them being written about by reporters ahead of time. But they're leaning on how the Norfolk Field Office report was," and then a quote, "raw and unverified information, which is surely the real answer for why the FBI didn't call Conte." Can you explain to my listeners and to me what's happening in regards to this Norfolk report and what responsibility the FBI may hold in all of this?
Yeah, sure thing. So this is another storyline. It's another reason why I wanted to say, like, as a reporter, like, I don't want to tell you exactly what I think happened because we're still gathering a lot of information. The night before the insurrection on January 5th, the Norfolk Field Office of the FBI puts together what has been described as a kind of raw and uncorroborated report that essentially summarizes a lot of really sick, you know, postings on platforms that are basically saying, like, you know, show up ready for war, it's time to spill blood. I forget specifically, like, what it says, but that was the gist of it. The FBI makes a point of passing that up its chain, but the day that it happens, the day that the insurrection happens, the chief of the D.C. police, Robert Conte, says that he doesn't get, like, really that kind of fulsome warning. And when he testified last week, he said that Yes, he found out that the night before this warning, this Norfolk FBI report was contained in an email he received. And he found that, like, really, he was incredulous about that. He's like, if you really think that some, you know, extremely dangerous, you know, situation is going to unfold on the streets of the city that he's, you know, charged with policing, don't you think a phone call would be on the order? And it's basically like, it looks a whole lot like the FBI is trying to have this both ways. On the one hand, I remember just like my whole, you know, series of like notifications to my editors ahead of January 6th was like, I am the guy who's going to be like watching for violence that we are, you know, expecting to see. That, you know, all you have to do is just have read like the papers and, you know, watch TV and seen social media over the days and the weeks leading up to this. This was not subtle. Like, tons of people were expecting violence. Like, those of us in the public, like, those of us who follow this stuff in the press, were expecting this to be a violent action after having seen however many antecedents unfold that way. And so it's amazing that the best the FBI can do is point to this one Norfolk memo, which under oath, senior FBI officials are cautioning. They're like, well, it's raw, it's unverified, and all of
okay,
that.
Okay, so then I'm curious here. What then are your sources saying about Capitol Police, who either actively aided rioters or passively allowed them to operate? Are you hearing any instances of real collusion between rioters and police that was organized before the fact? Because I think that's what you're trying to get to.
I would put it like this. It is not just an open question, but it is a test for the federal investigation. Right now, there is a misleading narrative out there, misleading because of how many Capitol Police officers testified that insurrectionists, like, showed their badges, whether being, like, active duty police, whether being retired police, active duty military, retired military. And then we just saw, like, a ton of imagery of Capitol Police either like standing out of the way as people rushed in or not, you know, particularly, you know, being motivated to help out. And also we saw imagery of Capitol Police escorting rioters delicately down the stairs. And you know, out of 800 people, there was something like 50 arrests. That's a huge basis for asking how much like active collusion, you know, took place in the moment. How many people in the Capitol Police force, you know, if it happens again, God forbid, can, you know, be relied upon to either repel the rioters or actually, you know, help them. It's a huge question, and we're not seeing charges on that yet. And it is a big open question whether the FBI is looking into that as well, or if that's just too politically dangerous, given pro-police sentiment, which, you know, certainly exists within the FBI.
Well, Spencer, you're bringing up active duty service members, and in essence, and I've heard this quite a bit, and I'd like to get your take onto it, that there are also a whole slew of them that are white supremacist extremists. And we heard this, if I'm not mistaken, from Defense Secretary Austin, who said that he expected numbers to be, and I'm going to quote it, a bit bigger than many of us expect. I think this is extremely dangerous, and I'm wondering how it just managed to sort of get past all of the higher-ups, all of the upper echelon, that you actually have active service members and members of our police force that are also engaged in white supremacy.
So a couple different things, and, you know, you'll forgive me if I'm, you know, talking about my book too much, but, you know, for the past 20 years, the people law enforcement and intelligence are looking at as terrorists are not white people. You know, we can dance around that as much as we want, but that's the fact that the image to law enforcement and intelligence of who is a dangerous person is not a white man with a flag and a gun and back the blue decals on his car, right? It's looking at Muslim kids. It is looking at immigrants. It is looking at foreigners. And overwhelmingly, over time, you have seen, like, particularly, you know, with Trump's embrace of Blue Lives Matter, a really disturbing sentiment on the part of a lot of cop shops around this country that they are part of this culture war, and the people that they are there to suppress are not white supremacist militiamen, people who are like willing to, you know, invade the U.S. Capitol on the vain hope of overturning an election, but instead other people, non-white people, poor people, black people especially. That is the essentially the target of not just policing locally, but, you know, policing federally and for national security reasons, essentially looking away. There's so many examples over the last 20 years of the coalescing white supremacist militias. One of the reasons for this is because, as we saw after Oklahoma City in 1995, too many powerful, politically powerful people on the right have, you know, spent a lot of effort trying to make sure that viewing those sorts of people as potential terrorists, as insurrectionists. I don't like the idea of treating anyone with a war on terror, just to be really clear about that. But the point I'm trying to make is politically powerful people kept that debate from happening, kept a reckoning with white supremacy and its ability to bleed into not just law enforcement, but in the military and be sheltered and sanctioned there. Remember, Timothy McVeigh was a decorated Army soldier. He was a Gulf War veteran. He got good responses on his evaluations, despite the fact that in his Army barracks, he wore a shirt that said White Pride that he got from a membership to the Ku Klux Klan. He wore that in full view of black soldiers in his own barracks. So this is a problem that, you know, Austin is talking about. He also said during that press conference that he believes like 99.9% of service members have nothing to do with white supremacy.
Absolutely. They have nothing to do with it. And the same thing holds true with the police department. There's always going to be that small, and I mean really small, fringe of individuals that, unfortunately, because of who they are, that they end up becoming the story. And it's really unfair to all of those, regardless of your color, that are in the military or in the police force, that they now have to be looked at differently simply because some of their brethren, right, are members of this white extremist. But I also want to bring up for a second, Spencer, about the Department of Homeland Security, because you recently wrote this. We are aware we have to invest more in understanding domestic terror. This is what we were just talking about. Testifies DHS Acting Intelligence Chief, inadvertently making an effective case for the abolition of the Department of Homeland Security. Can you unpack for my listeners what you meant here and how the DHS is unequipped to deal with this threat?
Thank you so much for that question, Michael. So let's give a quick review of the Department of Homeland Security. The Department of Homeland Security is the quintessential bureaucratic creation after 9/11. It is the result of Joe Lieberman, our old friend, the 2000 Democratic vice presidential nominee and former senator from Connecticut, along with his Republican colleague Arlen Specter, viewing an incoherency at the heart of the government's post 9/11 domestic counterterrorism initiative. And what the answer ends up being is pulling together this massive, like Frankenstein's monster of an agency, immigration enforcement from the Justice Department, aviation security from the Department of Transportation, and so on and so forth, until it becomes this massive, massive agency that's supposed to be devoted to ensuring that domestic terrorism in the United States simply does not occur. Now, the Department of Homeland Security has not just one job, but it does have that as its sort of defining ethos. That's the whole point of why it's quote-unquote Homeland Security. It's also a weird agency, as its policing powers are overwhelmingly in immigration enforcement, not in counterterrorism. It can perform analysis over certain events, but it has its ability to collect information is limited. That, of course, changed thanks to like the development over time of the war on terror and the empowerment of the harder edges of immigration enforcement. Those get collection activities anyway, but I digress. The point being, the Department of Homeland Security has, you know, that one basic mission to be looking out consistently across what it sees in the United States for instances of domestic terrorism and feeders to it. It looked, as you know, the story I tell in my book goes, overwhelmingly at Muslims and not at this coalescing white supremacist threat, militia threat, far-right threat, and so on and so forth. In 2009, an analyst inside a kind of backwater component of a DHS intelligence shop, a guy named Daryl Johnson, after Barack Obama is elected, puts together an analysis that says there's a real danger of rising right-wing extremism and militancy coinciding with the election of Barack Obama, that this is going to be a real threat. And Republicans went crazy about this. They talked overwhelmingly about how this was the prelude for Barack Obama coming to target them and treating them as the terrorists when they, in fact, were the good counterterrorists. And, you know, isn't America supposed to be about protecting, you know, the good guys from the bad guys, quote unquote? And overwhelmingly, the Obama administration decided it didn't want any part of that problem and just suppressed the analyst and let it go. And we are seeing overwhelmingly the fruits of that incredibly dangerous and neglectful and irresponsible decision. And when the Department of Homeland Security reaches a point where it says, after 20 years and however many hundreds of billions of dollars, that it doesn't really know if it has like such a great threat picture or even how to go about putting one together of who's a dangerous white supremacist extremist who might grow violent, well, you just signed your own tombstone. Like, that should be the bureaucratic last word on you. You are not, in fact, looking at domestic terrorism. You are looking at Muslims. That's what you were doing for the last 20 years. And if you couldn't see this really serious threat coalescing, I think it is time to ask really hard questions about whether we ought to have a Department of Homeland Security at all. Much as we ought to be asking, do we need a war on terror at all? Or has this all just been a disaster that's made us less free, less safe, and hate each other more?
Well, why is this any different than Trump's immigration ban, which we all know, and this is not opinion, this is fact, we all know that it was a Muslim ban. That was Donald Trump's intent when Steve Miller and Steve Bannon promoted the Muslim ban under the guise of it being immigration. But I do also, since we're talking about Trump again, on March 2nd, you described an amazing moment as Ted Cruz, someone who I think is one of the most fucking despicable human beings in this country, pushed the lie that Biden stole the election. Says January 6th didn't come out of nowhere before then pivoting away like the snake that he is, from the implication you, who is reading this tweet, understand. Discuss that implication with me if you can.
Yeah, sure thing. So here's Ted Cruz, like the guy in the hot dog from I Think You Should Leave costume, you know, talking like, you know, we're all trying to find who actually did this thing right here. Like, ultimately, Cruz is one of the Trumpists in the Senate who, up to January 6th, is relentlessly pushing that the election has been stolen from Trump, there are, you know, irregularities and so forth and so on. As one of the people who is bringing this riot to the Capitol by telling people, in a manner that I wonder if he even actually believes, and I'm not totally sure about that, that will be this insightful moment. That, you know, it's just playing with fire when you lie to people, and when you lie to people at scale, and that's what this was. And now all of a sudden, after this disaster happens, you've got Cruz and Josh Hawley, who, remember, saluted with his fist pump the insurrectionists as they approached the Capitol. Hawley and Cruz, you know, two members of the Senate who said they weren't going to vote for the certification, a dereliction of constitutional duty. Not that, you know, not that it seems like, you know, a lot of people in Congress are interested in disciplining their own. But nevertheless, Cruz and Hawley are on this committee, and they have to ask questions of, you know, the Capitol Police, the National Guard, the FBI, the Department of Homeland Security, and so forth, while trying assiduously, as hard as they can, to avoid talking about their own culpability in this sort of thing. And this is what, you know, strikes me as, you know, one of, like, the kind of atmospheric things hovering over all of the January 6th hearings in Congress so far, which is that they want to talk about this overwhelmingly as a security failure, a failure of the FBI to collect sufficient information and distribute it, a failure of the Pentagon suppressing the National Guard from the Capitol, a failure of the Capitol Police, and so on and so forth. All of those things appear to have been real components of what happened, but it's not the full story. The full story is about the way in which powerful politicians in this country on the right had decided that they would stoke this because, I don't know, you had the one guy, anonymously quoted in the Washington Post, talking about, like, would it be so bad if, we just let Trump have his temper tantrum and so forth. And, we see the wages of that right now. It turned out it was so bad. It turns out appeasement doesn't work. It turns out appeasement makes all of this stuff a lot more volatile, a lot more dangerous. People died on January 6th. People committed suicide afterward. Like, this is just such a compounding disgrace. And it seems, admittedly this is early and admittedly we have, incomplete information. But it really seems like they are trying in Congress now to kind of, conveniently memory hole the degree to which elected officials, their colleagues, stoked this because it is simply too incendiary a political question to talk about the degree to which there is now a normalized movement with a home in the Republican Party against democracy. This is an enormous, if not the most urgent political question there is. And if we only view it as a security problem, we're only going to get a security-based solution. It's only going to be going after not just low-level people who took part in the insurrection, but it's going to be about stoking another war on terror. It's going to be about giving the security agencies more authorities. It's going to be about making Americans less free. And if you think that this is okay, because right now it will be focused against, people who, liberals might, disagree with and view, not without reason, as genuine danger, wait until there's another Republican president and watch as how these powers, as they always have been, will be used against non-white people and will be used against the left wing in this country.
Well, 100%, no different than the way that Trump empowered the Department of Justice to come after me, not once but twice. But Spencer, I will say that I loved your retweet from August of last year, and you wrote, Andrew Cuomo is to coronavirus what Rudy Giuliani was to 9/11. In a crisis, his authoritarian tendencies get retconned as leadership and their destructive impact on people forgotten. When it comes time for the next phase of his ambition, there'll be bewilderment regarding his behavior. Unpack this for me and my listeners in the context now of Cuomo's latest sexual harassment scandal. Do you believe him to be as compromised a human as Rudy is?
Oh, absolutely. And, all you really had to do, Alex Perina of the New Republic had a wonderful piece on this the other day. All you really had to do to understand what Cuomo was is read the papers and pay the slightest bit of attention over the last 10 years, or, longer when, I was a kid, but, he was, his father's political aide. Cuomo has always been a bully. Cuomo has always been someone for whom power appears like its own end. He can be politically protean that way, kind of like how Trump is, certainly how Giuliani is. The ends can shift. There's not a whole lot, outside of, certain, I don't know if this is true for Cuomo, but, with Trump and with Giuliani, certain really noxious political tendencies, specifically, all the racism and the comfort with lying and with brutality. I don't think Cuomo is, is like that in that specific sense. But there was, all throughout 2020, a package narrative delivered by, Cuomo's brother on CNN that, here was this take charge guy who was, doing everything that, Trump wasn't willing to do with the coronavirus. And here is someone that you can trust. And that just wasn't simply compatible with 10 years of, Governor Cuomo, bullying behavior. And, this is admittedly a little personal. I have an aunt who is a ward of New York State who I found out in, I guess, December, early January must have been, had tested positive for the coronavirus. And, thankfully she is okay, or at least so I've been told. I don't honestly know how much I can believe at this point. But this happened shortly before It was reported, you know, that Tish James, the Attorney General of New York, has an investigation now out after determining that the Cuomo government covered up thousands of deaths of people's loved ones in nursing homes. And I just don't know. I was kind of taken aback and without words that, you know, someone whom, you know, the media had so consistently, you know, portrayed against the available evidence as a heroic figure in coronavirus had done this. And had done this to, you know, I'm getting tongue-tied.
Yeah, you know, I'm going to tell you, Spencer, I never really followed much of Cuomo over the course of my years. I was really much more involved in the Washington politics to the extent that I wasn't doing my shit for Trump, right? So I never really saw Cuomo. I never had much to do with him other than to say that Trump never cared for the Cuomo family, despite the fact that Cuomo's mom and Trump's mom were actually friends. Trump never cared for Andrew Cuomo. He never really cared for Chris Cuomo either. But what bothers me the most is all of these allegations now that are coming out. And I say, as he does, let the process take its place. You know, it's a little bit different, in my estimation, than Anthony Weiner with his dick pic or Spitzer with the prostitute, right? But Cuomo has to stand responsible for the allegations, assuming that they're true, that these women are bringing forth. And that's the nice thing about the truth. It will always find its way up, right? The thing that bothers me the most as I'm now reading and learning more about Cuomo, and again, I've been in New York my entire life, is I'm not sure that Cuomo has actually ever done anything that has legitimately benefited New York. I truly cannot figure out what it is that's out there that he has done. And that's why I'm saying to all New Yorkers who may be listening to this program, it's really time we start to look at people who are going to actually do things that benefit the state, that benefit the, you know, the taxpayers of New York. And look, people are leaving New York at an alarming rate. Why? Because between city, state, federal, you know, who can really afford to live in New York and why? I mean, Florida's new calling cry is sick and tired of paying stupid taxes in New York. Hey, come on to us. The weather's better, right? So I don't understand this year after year after year, people continuing to, you know, support the likes of Cuomo. I think it's really about time that people start looking at their politicians, the guys that have been in there 14, 16, 20 years. And it's time to say, maybe it's time that they get a real job, right? And stop sucking off of, right, the, you know, the financial tit of the state. It's really, I think it's disgusting. I think we really need to start putting in people that care more about New York, that care more about us as the citizens than they care about their own political, you know, ambitions. And obviously we know Cuomo has some pretty high, you know, ambitions for himself. But let me go then to the next thing as we're beginning to wind down our hour. In a February 26th piece for the Daily Beast, you write about the DOJ opening the door to seeking new domestic terrorism powers. And this really fascinated me, by the way. And then you tweeted that it could be one of the most ominous steps the Biden administration takes. Discuss this with me, if you would.
Yeah, so in the immediate days after January 6th, a big left-right civil libertarian coalition, knowing, you know, the memory of 9/11 and how quickly they passed the Patriot Act and ultimately established the Department of Homeland Security and, you know, so on and so forth, would likely be the template that people in Washington would reach for this time, you know, those in the Democratic Party rather than the Republican Party. And this coalition instead said, you know, when you look at the available authorities for going after the specific people who committed the insurrection, federal law enforcement already has every power they could possibly want to charge. And against that, a small but, you know, starting, but a really growing, you know, effort began, often, you know, people who were former FBI officials or former, you know, federal law enforcement started to push for a domestic terrorism statute. What do we mean by that? So unlike with Al-Qaeda or ISIS or other, you know, foreign-based terrorist groups, there is no domestic, there is no way to designate a specific group in the United States that's just among Americans a terrorist group. And what the implications of that really are that, you know, you can't basically do a Patriot Act on them, which is to say criminalize, you know, their sources of funding, criminalize people who give them specific help. And one of the reasons that people have, for 20 years, pushed back against the Patriot Act there is that, you know, doing so in the way the Patriot Act does, the way a domestic terrorism statute would, just expands the circle of who law enforcement, prosecutors, and intelligence can look at and bring charges against. Overwhelmingly in this country, the hundreds of people who ended up in jail, ended up in federal prison, I should say, through Justice Department counterterrorism prosecutions, were not people who committed acts of violence. They were people who committed acts of funding, some knowingly and some not, and as well, people whom FBI undercover agents or confidential informants essentially, you know, coerced or encouraged, or if you want to get a little, you know, more controversial about it, entrapped people who they were targeting who had just, like, said noxious stuff on social media into, like, committing, you know, crimes, purchasing, like, tons of fertilizer that could be repurposed as an explosive and other kinds of banned material. That is what has started now from the FBI over the last couple, I guess, you know, maybe 2 weeks worth of testimony and press conferences and so forth, started to open the door to. The FBI has started to kind of lean away from saying we have every authority we need into sort of suggesting to Congress that, you know, if you wanted to give us more power, we would eagerly take that. No one's ever going to say no to that. So are you willing to do that? And I think if we look at the wages of 20 years of the war on terror, it's a disaster. It's an unmitigated disaster. It's something that made us, again, less free, less safe. It distributed a ton of wealth upward to defense contractors, wealth we desperately need in this country for working people. And at the end, what did it get us? Not a whole lot. It certainly didn't stop us from getting the January 6th insurrection. And if you liked the first movie, I would suggest, like, you're going to like the sequel, which is what, you know, we're in danger of seeing develop in there. I'll editorialize a little bit because, you know, it's in my book already and it's in my writing. But there is a real concern that's going to, you know, play out, I think, over the next several months over whether, you know, by drift or design, either can work. The response to January 6th is going to be to target a very large group of people who might believe in things that I find disgusting, but haven't actually threatened or posed a danger to other people. And that is just not simply, I think, the country that a lot of us want and the country that I think any of us deserve.
Right, but I think that it's really fair to point out that the FBI and our law enforcement, being that they are the best of the best, that there has to be something that they can do. I mean, think about it. You can't go on the fucking airplane anymore with a bottle of water, right? Some asshole sticks a string in his sneaker, right? And now you have to take your shoes off worldwide. There has to be something that could be done in order to keep us safe, to keep us protected, that doesn't necessarily over-infringe upon our rights as U.S. citizens, but will also let us feel safe and be safe and to continue. But the biggest problem, in my opinion, is the fact that Trump undermined the legitimacy and the authority of the FBI and of law enforcement. And he spent 4 solid years basically dismantling them, pulling them apart, making them like the rest of us at the Trump organization, running around trying to figure, do you need to go to the left? Do you need to go to the right? Am I going upstairs? Am I going downstairs? Never really understanding, because he never fully understood what was going on. And what Captain Chaos would then do is just sow more chaos so that he could end up trying to effectuate what he wanted. And I say this, and I'm saying this with facts. I fucking hate all these people that keep talking innuendo. Well, you know, I think that it's not about thinking anymore. It's now fact is important. Facts matter. And the fact of the matter is Donald Trump does not want to be president of the United States. He wants to be like Vladimir Putin. He wants to be an autocrat. He wants to be a monarch, just like Mohammed bin Salman. He wants to be a dictator like Kim Jong-un. That's who he is, and that's what he wants, plain and simple. And anybody that doesn't see it is either blind or just doesn't want to see it for whatever their own personal reasons may be.
You know, all I would add to that is, you know, to speak to, you know, the question that you posed about what is it we can do. On the one hand, the FBI has been saying that, you know, it's arrested over 270 people, you know, people who actually, you know, it has reason to believe committed these specific crimes. So it seems like they actually have the power to do a fair amount. But more to the point, you know, when you bring up Trump, if the country doesn't honestly reckon with the forces that, you know, it's not just Trump creating them. All Trump did, all the war on terror did, was unleash them. These have been, you know, nativist forces all throughout American history, white supremacist forces all, you know, throughout American history, class war forces from the rich against the poor all throughout American history. All Trump did was channel them in a direction that was beneficial for him and for his movement. Unless we challenge that, a political act, not a security act, we're just going to end up right back here with more and worse of the same. And, you know, whatever, you know, arrests, you know, the FBI and so forth make will just be the arrests of one wave and more of this come through. The war on terror is pretty conclusively failed. Why do it again?
Well, you're right. Now, as we're winding down the hour, Spencer, I basically have one last question for you. And it refers back to a February 23rd tweet that you wrote. They're going to call this an intelligence failure so as to avoid the actually necessary conversation about the mainstreamed far-right politics that fueled it. Now, there's a very familiar resonance from 2002 to 2004. Can you explain this to my listeners?
All of this at length is in my book, Reign of Terror, which Viking will publish in August. So if you want to hear a longer version about that, please, please, please pre-order the book. But in general, what happened after 9/11 was a political establishment that did not want to deal with the fact that the United States was the overwhelming unipolar superpower that essentially determines what the rules-based international order is, along with its allies and the institutions through which it works. I believe in such a circumstance, an attack like 9/11 was kind of inevitable when you're in a circumstance of such awful power. That doesn't mean remotely to excuse it. It doesn't mean remotely that there aren't serious answers to be had with why that particular attack was able to succeed. And it doesn't mean remotely that it was okay or that the United States deserved it. My neighbors did not deserve to die in the World Trade Center. Ultimately, what we have to look at is how the structural forces that we unleash lead to reckonings like this. And if we don't ultimately do that, if we're not willing to ask ourselves if, like, we need to be the world's policeman, then all we're going to end up doing is looking at the very specific mistakes after the fact that, you know, no intelligence official is going to be completely omniscient. And it will end up turning into an excuse not to deal with the problem, but to only deal with its manifestations. The intelligence community couldn't, you know, solve 9/11, couldn't infiltrate it, couldn't ultimately predict it before it happened with, you know, sufficient force to stop it. Well, we better allow the creation of a global surveillance dragnet under the NSA. We better assemble a Department of Homeland Security. We better pass a Patriot Act to make everybody's records less secure, and weaken the Fourth Amendment, and so on and so forth. And all of this seems like a really important bit of prologue to understand and review now that we're considering what to do after January 6th, And if you're interested in that backstory, if you're interested in that context, and if you're interested in its resonance to the present day, please, 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 pre-order Reign of Terror from Viking Books coming out in August.
Spencer, I got to tell you, I'm looking forward to reading your book. And, you know, one of the things that I have to acknowledge is you certainly have this this area down pat. It's very scary where we're at today because it's not just the ideology. It's the ability of these groups in order to communicate just so easily, whether it's these encrypted apps, whether it's other types of back channels that didn't exist prior to, or they're just so easy now. You know, everybody has a cell phone and they have these encrypted apps. They're able to communicate with each other. Look, I'm all for, you know, increasing intelligence and making sure that we're safe, of course, to a certain extent. But look, I want to thank you for your insight. I want to thank you for all of your great writings. And thank you, most importantly, for coming on the show. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, Michael. Next time, I hope we can talk a little bit about the Yankees, because I understand you, like me, are a big fan.
Yes, I am. I am, and I can't wait to get out of home confinement so I can go to a game. And I can't wait for this pandemic to be over so that I can actually go there and have a couple of hot dogs. So, Spencer, I will see you there.
All right. Thank you very much, Michael.
Be good.
And now for today's mea culpa. That Andrew Cuomo should crumble so suddenly from hero to disgrace is something that politicians and cultural figures need to take heed. The intoxication of fame, even by proximity, is a powerful drug that can completely overpower your better senses if you don't check yourself. Cuomo's aides did him a disservice in trying to clean up his record by hiding and rewriting those health department reports. First and foremost, it's illegal and morally reprehensible. But moreover, they started down a path from which there is no return. Once a lie gets told, then hidden, it begins to compound upon itself. And the lie generates new lies and further untruths. Pretty soon, you find yourself unable to remember who or what you used to be because you've spent so much time trying to rewrite somebody else's reality. But the truth always comes out, no matter how big the lie. That they thought they could change something as fundamental as death statistics and not get caught, knowing that they had bullied and angered scores of health professionals, is just imbecilic and naive. But they had already crossed the line they could not uncross. Their truth was the only truth that mattered. This is something I personally experience on a daily basis working for fucking Donald Trump. There was only one reality that mattered, and it was the one conjured and spun by him. If you wanted to keep your job and your proximity to fame, you would do just about anything to maintain this delusion. My life became oriented around keeping his various lies and half-truths in place. For a time, it was thrilling, but slowly it eats away at you like acid and becomes toxic, and all you're doing is swimming through a river of shit. I say all of this because Andrew Cuomo is living proof of what I am trying to say. You can see the pain in his face and on the purse of his lips. He knows he's finished. The bigger lie, the more people are inclined to believe. But it's also a burden you must carry with you day in and day out. Andrew Cuomo, it seems, has come to a watershed moment. What he does next will determine not only his political future, but whether or not he can escape the shackles of his own lies. It's a weight most people can't and do not want to carry. I gave it up when I turned on Donald Trump, and it saved my life. I'm curious to see if Andrew Cuomo will do the same. And thanks for listening.